I call to order a meeting of the House Interim Committee on Judiciary for Thursday, September 25, 2008.
I call to order a subcommittee meeting of the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary. As you can see, I will be the member representing the subcommittee until other senators arrive.
We have an informational meeting today of the two committees and with several items. And the first item in our informational meeting is a report on the law library filing fees pursuant to a budget note accompanying House Bill 2331B.
Committee, you will see in your notebook a whole series of information on law library filing fees. This report is a result of a budget note that was added in Ways and Means Committee to House Bill 2331B. Pursuant to that, we requested from the Court Administrator's Office how much money was collected for law library filing fees. It's approximately $7 million a biennium. I checked the statute. The statute goes back to 1927. I actually went down to the archives to check the committee minutes and stuff. There are none. At the end of session, the chair of the committee took the records home with him, and we really didn't start keeping track of committee records until the middle 60s. So other than the plain meaning of the statutes, I really can't tell you what their thinking was at the time, but it's an old statute, and the money goes basically to support law libraries, and each county has one. And they vary in amounts of money, from very small amounts of money for small counties to significant sums of money for some of the larger counties. And then you'll have in your book breakdown by counties as how they spend the money. Beyond that, we also asked them how many customers they had, and you will see that in the written information also. You have Mr. Marquis, who I'm here to testify. I believe that they were instrumental in getting the budget note, and can probably tell you better what the thinking was on the review. And we have two witnesses, one from the county commissioner and the head of the Law Library Association, as to what they do, and et cetera.
Okay. Mr. Marquis. Could we hear from you about the sort of background on the budget note, so we know what it is we're being urged to consider here?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Kump.
Thank you. While we're transitioning, I'm going to say to everybody that helped put us back in our homeroom of 357, thank you. It feels good to be home.
Okay. This is a great hearing room with a storied tradition.
Considering where we could be in the annex, I agree. It would be great to be home.
Mr. Chair, your staff is in the annex with our files and boxes. So.
Mr. Marquis.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing the Oregon Collectors Association, and we are here today because of the budget note, which was partly due to our asking. Every session, it seems like, for as long as I can remember, and I've only been doing this since 97, but every session we look at filing fees, we look at ways to raise additional funds for legal aid, dispute resolution, the courts, everything else that's tied to the filing fees. And every session, the issue of law libraries, which is before us today, comes up. Last session, we increased a lot of filing fees, and including answer fees. And so in the process of doing that, actually the law library fee was reduced to the current fee today, which is 28%. When you look at ORS 9.850, which states that all these monies that are collected for law libraries have to be spent on law libraries, and as was reported to you earlier, you have about $7 million a biennium being collected and supposedly spent on law libraries. It just raises a question every time you start to look at this as to what is the money being spent on, and is there a better way maybe to spend it? Today we have a good start. We have this notebook. There's a lot of information in it. I've been through it several times, as has our clients. There's still some questions that are left to be answered here. We're collecting about $7 million a biennium. We're spending, I'm not sure exactly how much, but probably something less than that. And one question that came to our mind was ending balances and how much is actually being carried over from some of these counties. Some of these counties, I'll tell you, are spending more than they're collecting, and they're raising additional funds other places, and others are spending less. It's just kind of, it's hard to get a grasp still a little bit as how all this money is being spent. Our clients are high users of the court system. Filing fees are important to us. We watch them closely. And we're not necessarily looking to reduce the overall fee of a filing fee, but we're looking to make sure that all fees that are collected are spent in their most efficient ways. As an example, last session, the legislature, starting next biennium, will have reduced the dispute resolution fee, and a like amount will have been transferred to legal aid. This was done because it was found that dispute resolution was collecting more than was currently being spent on their programs, and legal aid needed additional funds. And while we were while we're supportive of legal aid and making sure that they are needing as much money as they do, we didn't want to raise additional fees on top of that. So as we examine all of these fees, we saw that dispute resolution was collecting an additional amount more than being spent, and made a shift, or suggested a shift that was later then adopted by the legislature. Right now we have the judicial department that is undertaking a huge task in creating e-court. It's a huge, very expensive program. But they were just at one of our conventions last week and stated that, you know, law libraries could be done very simply as part of the e-court, and you could have a virtual law library housed through e-court with terminals at every court throughout the state. Maybe that's a way to look at things. Maybe you could shift some of this money towards e-court, which we're having issues with trying to come up with how to fund anyway. To help with that task, I think it would probably be a more cost-efficient way to do something like that. The other thing that's out there are court facilities. Everybody knows that our court facilities are in dire need of repairs and deferred maintenance and what have you. It's a huge price tag, and while this isn't the answer to it, this maybe could be one place to look as far as if we came up with something that would work statewide for law libraries. If the e-court solution of a virtual law library works, and I'm not saying it does because I don't know, but it's something that I think we should look into, maybe that also frees up a little bit of money for court facilities. There's a lot of policy decisions that I just think that this legislature could look at and examine a little closer as far as how we're running our law libraries, who all is using the law libraries, the number of participants that are there, and so forth, and to even see if the number of participants is increasing or decreasing. And I'm sure you'll probably hear all of this from the people testifying after me, but these are questions that we have brought forth trying to find answers for to see if there's just a better, efficient way of doing business. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, before we take questions, I'm going to do a formality here. The Senate is now opening up as a full committee the Interim Committee of Judiciary. Thank you.
Good. Yeah, Ms. Marquis, you said that the law library fee is 28%. That's of the 28% of the filing fee on civil actions. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct, yes.
And what, to remind me, and for the benefit of other people here in the committees, two committees, so for a civil action, what magnitude are we talking about here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you know what? I do not have that in front of me, I don't think. I believe a filing fee is, I'm going to say, the base fee without the additionals is around $50 in circuit court, I think. I'm not exactly sure. So 28% of that is, I don't know, $15. Is that right? Somewhere in that ballpark.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, honestly, Mr. Chair, I don't have that exact figure with me today.
Okay. Any other questions?
This is more of a comment. I think the only thing I want to make certain is that there's probably a better way to do what we're doing at the county levels. But clearly, I know for my practice and going in, I see so many people that are pro se representing themselves needing to have access. So I don't hear your client saying that we should shut down or close off these avenues and just looking at more efficiencies.
Mr. Chair, Senator Przanski. Yeah, exactly. We're not looking. I think law libraries serve a purpose. I think there's no question about that. I think it's just a matter of whether or not we should be buying the same books for every law library across the state, or if there is a way to do it virtually with terminals set up, you know, in every courthouse that are you could access this online. I think there's just some questions to be to look at as far as if it's the most efficient way.
Representative Harker.
Given my background in technology, I can't help but be intrigued by what you're saying here, and I wonder who are contact people for me to learn about the status of whatever efforts there are in this area. I'm new to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Harker, the e-court is being done by the Judicial Department. Sarah Gates has been our contact person that has been running that. She gave us a large presentation last week. The question was asked of her during that presentation if something like this could be made a part of e-court, and her response was they had talked about that, and it definitely was something that they were considering. E-court in general is a process of filing all of your documents with the court electronically rather than going down to the courthouse and handing in a stack of papers. But she said as they go through that process that the idea of a virtual law library is very plausible and doable.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you. Does the law board, a new facility, I was at recently, do they have is all their the laws on electronically, or is it a hard copy? Is it?
When you say the law board,
the association, the state board,
the Oregon State Bar.
Yeah.
There are research services that are available through other sources than the county law libraries. And Mr. Marquis, do you have any information about what alternative points of access, particularly to electronic sources, are available to the public?
You know. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have Westlaw, you have LexisNexis, all of those types of products are available online, but honestly, beyond that, as far as where you can access those from a public standpoint, I'm sure some law libraries do it this way currently, and others are still doing a hardback. It might be a question to better ask of the law library themselves, though.
And if I could, University of Oregon's Law School, it's a public facility that people can go to, but, of course, it's limited. I don't know what, if any, services they have that would be web-based that you could access. And as Mr. Marquis has said, there are numerous vendors. I know Lois Law is another one that you can actually access, one of the offices I work with. So I can actually do that from my home office. But having access points, we would still need to have places where people could go to access it like a public library to get on a computer.
Yes, sir.
Okay. If there are no further questions, then we'll excuse Mr. Marquis.
Thank you.
And we have a couple of witnesses I understand want to appear on this issue. Jacqueline Jerkins of Multnomah County.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name is Jackie Jerkins, and I'm the law librarian at the Multnomah Law Library. First, I want to thank the committee for giving me an opportunity to respond to that 2007 budget NOTA HB 2331. I also want to thank Bill Taylor and his staff for reviewing and compiling that those buried responses that he received from the county law library. As you know, legislation provided for the creation and the funding of the county law library by a portion of the litigant filing fee, with the provision that the monies received for the law library may not be used for any purpose other than acquiring, maintaining, or operating a law library. These funds are paid over to the county, and since the counties, since the law libraries are county facilities, each county determines the allocation of these funds. In an attempt to create a simple chart showing how the county law library dollar is spent, and the distribution of the County Law Library's users. I sent an email questionnaire to the county law librarians asking these three questions for the fiscal year 2006-2007. First, I asked what they spent on publication, on personnel, on administrative operations and support, and then all other expenses. The second question was, what percent of lawyer and non-lawyer users during the year they had? And the third question is, what changes in use by lawyers and non-lawyers they observed? Nine representative Oregon County Law Librarians responded, and I think you'll see the little chart that I brought. You'll see that the county law library do spend the greater part of their revenue on books and online services. The amount spent varies from library to library depending upon different factors, such as staff costs, location of the library, space available, and, of course, fee money received. Personnel costs are also a major expenditure. The law library staff may range from a full-time professional librarian with an MLS or a JD or both degrees to a part-time person in the DA's office, usually the receptionist. The number of hours the law library is open is generally a factor affecting how much is spent on personnel. In the past, the county law library's mandate was to serve the judges and lawyers. Today, the county law library serves the non-lawyer, the pro se litigant, and in addition to the more diverse legal community. Technology has changed the way lawyers use the county law library. Use by the law lawyer is tending downward because of the availability of more online resources in their office or firm. Every Oregon lawyer has access to CaseMaker as part of their State Bar membership. Many law firms also subscribe to Westlaw and or Lexis, Lois Law, or LawNet. These are commercial services, and they focus on case law. Current primary resources, such as statutes, session laws, and administrative rules for Oregon and most states, are available free on the Internet, as well as on the subscription services. The significant word is current. The prior statutes and administrative rules are not maintained or archived online. For example, Measure 37 or Measure 11 issues require researching the old statutes and ordinances that were in effect at the time the property in question was obtained or the crime committed. For this research, litigants and lawyers alike turn to the county law library. Legal treatises and periodicals generally are not part of a basic online subscription, and they're not found on the Internet. These are the resources the lawyer and the non-lawyer come to the county law library to use. Yesterday, a lawyer was talking to me, and he told me that the county law library levels the playing field for the solo practitioner. And this is true for the pro se litigant, too. A national study has found that in Oregon, 50% of the eligible people seeking assistance from legal aid services are turned away. The study points out there is a serious justice gap in Oregon. Also, research shows that at least one party will represent himself or herself in over two-thirds of Oregon's family law cases. Family law problems are among the most common legal issues facing the pro se litigant who comes to the county law library. Landlord-tenant issues, small claim issues, bankruptcy and foreclosure issues, and traffic violations are the other reasons the pro se patron comes to the county law library. Generally, the first words out of a pro se patron's mouth are, "The clerk sent me to the library to get a form," or, "Clerk said you could help me find the law," and always, "I can't afford a lawyer." Equal access to equal justice has become a mantra of the state's courts and bar. Oregonians expect a judicial system that is acceptable to all. Accessible. My mouth is getting dry, sorry. The county library has become an integral and vital partner in meeting the state's goal of equal access to equal justice. Its resources are accessible to everyone. Since 1997, the county library's income from litigant filing fee has been reduced from 40%, thank you, to 28%. Excuse me, thank you again. However, like every other county department, all operating expenses have gone up. For example, the annual cost of legal materials has increased anywhere from 8% to 20%. And further cutting or elimination of the county law library funding with a portion of the litigant filing fee will significantly contribute to the justice gap in Oregon. Just let me, I'd like to do a little show and tell here. Friday, we received this volume. It's Wigmore on Evidence. It's the second half of the 2008 supplement to the work, and it is a noted work. It's an authoritative resource. I have here the invoice, and it totals $548. In 1997, the annual supplement cost us $208. This, I said, was the second supplement this year. The first supplement only cost us $469.80. So the total cost for 2008 is going to be $917.80. And the publisher had the foresight of including with the invoice a return label. And you can be assured that's going to be in the mail tomorrow. And I want to add one more thing. This is the type of material that is not found online and even on the paid subscription services. And I thank you for your time. Thanks. May I help?
Yes, thank you, Ms. Jurgens. We appreciate the information. I have a question about the, just focusing on the Multnomah County statistics that were in our binder here. It shows the number of attorney and non-attorney users. Mm-hmm. And is those counts each visit, physical visit by a patron to the law library, or is it the number of people who at any point during the period came into it?
We count only warm bodies. We don't count telephone calls or use of the conference room, emails, faxes. We do a lot of faxing and electronic transfer of data to the jail and to the different county law libraries around the state. But we count only someone who comes in, and we don't count them, you know, when they go out to the restroom or come back. We consider one visit one person.
But if the same user, say it's one of the judge's clerks, for example,
uh-huh,
came to the law library each day, each visit by each that individual would be a
each
visit.
Each day, but not mm-hmm, each time they walked in or out of the library.
Mm-hmm. And to what extent are the services accessible by people who never physically appear? That is, can a person call in,
yes,
or by remote connection connect to online services through the law library?
Well, we don't have online services that we can simply, you can't call in on your computer and ask us to transfer or to give you access to what our services are as far as online. Like, we have Westlaw, obviously. We can't connect you. You'd have to have a password. So actually, you would have to come into the law library. But if you give me a fax situation, and this is true of only attorneys, we don't practice law in the library. But if you gave me a fax situation, I could run the reference question on the computer and email you the results so that you could, if you needed a case, a decision, we could email that to you. Or if that's not convenient, there are a lot of people that don't like to read online, we can fax it to you. And we do that all the time. But unfortunately, we don't count those because actually we're too busy to take time to write down every person or every call.
Okay. Well, if I'm following it correctly, then a person who comes in physically, that they can be connected to, say, to Westlaw,
yes,
themselves,
yes,
on a computer that's in the law library.
Yes.
But and there's some opportunity to get remote service by calling in by telephone, and then you'll look something up and then
yes,
provide it.
Or we take emails too. But mm-hmm, but we do try to provide access as best we can with whatever service we have.
Okay. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Jerkins, for being here. In your pie chart that you passed out, you have 45% of the budget is for publications. Is it correct that the subscription fees for services like Westlaw are included in that 45%?
Yeah, they are.
Do you happen to know what part of that 45% goes for things like Westlaw, Alexis? What percentage of that 45 goes to the online services?
Well, first I'll explain why I didn't include it in that pie chart and lumped the services, the online services and the publications into one. When I sent that out, the responses, some did not, and I knew they had computer services in their library, but they didn't indicate if they hadn't broke. They didn't break it down for me, so I didn't feel it was accurate to try and just separate the online from the publication because I didn't believe it was going to represent the amount of money that's spent for resources in the library. I can tell you that the online services are, there are two things. The online services are becoming more and more expensive. 1979, that goes way back, was the first time, we were the first library to install Westlaw. And at that time, 1 hour of Westlaw cost us $60, and that included the terminal, the communication charge, the printer, the paper. It was the whole thing for $60 an hour. I found out this week, well, costs have gone up for 6 weeks, but one county library is subscribing for just 20 minutes a month, and their cost for that 20 minutes is $300. And it doesn't include the paper, the communication cost, and the terminal. So I think that may be to give you an idea of what our costs are, how our costs are escalating. And then the other thing that I don't think any survey has shown, that many of our print publications are tied to the online services. If you have an online service, the publisher still requires that you have the print. And there are other services, for example, the periodicals. There is a periodical service online, but it is not the current material. So that even if I subscribe to, as I do, to the service, I cannot access anything within the last 2 years. So I still have to have the print material. The publishers have found ways to keep the print and the hard copy tied together.
Thank you.
Any other things?
Representative Kump.
Very briefly, Chair, thank you. How do you determine what what books you keep and what do you send back?
Well, my criteria is, first, I have to look at the cost. I cannot ignore that. But I also weigh that against how much value the material has for as a research tool in my library. For example, our library, way back when, had every jurisdiction, every English-speaking jurisdiction material, both primary and secondary. As money started drying up, we cut out first anything that was duplicated, anything that was foreign, and I mean international foreign. We at one time had every province of Canada in our collection. Today, we keep the BC code and case law, because we have a lot of litigation, or at least Portland attorneys have litigation up there, and they want a quick reference to the case law and their statutes. So it's use, research value, and cost, pretty much.
Thank you.
Any further
that
questions?
That goes true for the online, too. You have to look at the online services.
Anything further from Ms. Jerkins?
Anything?
Thank you, ma'am. We appreciate your coming and sharing this information.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
And we have Commissioner Joseph Lawrence from Douglas County, then. We've heard from the most metropolitan of our counties, and now we'll hear from another one of our counties.
And I thank you very much, Chairman Przanski, Chairman McPherson, ladies and gentlemen of the interim committees. And joining me is Diana Hadley, my library, and I'm scared to death you'll ask some questions, so I've brought the person that answers my questions and has for the last couple of years. Last week, while in Washington, D.C., seeking support for county forest payments and secure rural schools funding, I passed the Supreme Court building. Engraved under the portico is the legend, equal justice under law. I thought the end of this hearing and the needs of my constituents in these difficult times.
And Commissioner, for just sure. Even though I called your name out before, could you identify yourself for the record as
Pardon
part
me,
of our process
will.
Of making a record of the proceedings?
My name is Joseph Lawrence. I am chairman of the Douglas County Board of Commissioners.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I apologize. Once again, I'll begin. I've only got one way to do this from the top, so excuse me. Last week, while in Washington, D.C., seeking support for county forest payments and secure rural schools funding, I passed the Supreme Court building. Engraved on that portico was the legend, equal justice under law. I thought then of this hearing and the needs of my constituents in these difficult times. I thought, too, of a quote from Thomas Jefferson who said, quote, the people of every country are the only safe guardians of their own rights, unquote. As public servants, we all are charged to help those we serve achieve this lofty goal. The cornerstone of democracy is equal access to justice through our court system. Oregon's county law libraries play an important role in access to justice for all. Anyone can walk through the doors of a county law library and receive assistance in locating materials to help them navigate the maze of the courts. Legal aid and public defenders play a vital role in meeting the needs of the disenfranchised of our communities, but are limited in who they are able to assist by income, type of case, and conflicts with other parties in the case. County law libraries have no such restrictions and play a crucial role in our constituents' access to justice because of this neutral position. County law libraries provide essential services for all members of the community. They do not limit their services based on income, type of case, or any other qualifiers. Many, but not all, of Oregon's counties are fortunate enough to have staff, trained professionals who can guide library visitors to appropriate materials for their needs and instruct them in the use of those materials. That does not mean they give legal advice or act as an attorney might. As our economy tightens, the need for county law libraries grows. Many of my constituents cannot afford an attorney. Their only source of legal information may be from the county law library. Public libraries do not contain the specialized materials of the law library, and access to law school libraries is an insurmountable obstacle for those in southern and eastern Oregon, as well as those along the coast. Oregon's law schools are located in the major cities of the Willamette Valley. The rising cost of gas prices challenges those in rural areas to drive to the nearest county law library. Driving to the Willamette Valley is out of the question for many of the economically disadvantaged. Many people believe all manner of legal material is available online. This is true to an extent, but not in the way most people might think. There are many legal resources available online, but most of the best materials are only available online through expensive databases. For those economically challenged, access to the materials can only be through their local county law library, who may have a print copy of the material or a subscription to the database, which will not cost the person more than a simple copy fee. The other reality is not everyone who has legal needs is computer literate, nor has access to the Internet. Many county law libraries provide some kind of computer access and will assist those needing help in finding websites pertinent to their case. 99% of the county law library's budget comes from 28% of the Uniform Civil Court filing fee. It needs to be more. These funds must cover all materials, personnel, equipment, supplies, and other needs of the facility. Some counties charge an administrative fee to their law libraries to cover square footage used, electricity, and maintenance. The price of materials inflates between 8 and 20% each year. In Douglas County, the law library operates on approximately $1.20 per capita per year. In comparison, last year Douglas County Public Library expended approximately $23.50 per capita, not including grants and other gifts. Most law libraries are open very limited hours to the general public. When looking at the expenditure per capita, it's easy to see why. County law libraries also have to maintain a savings account of some kind in anticipation of future needs for equipment, software, supplies, and other expected and unexpected future expenses. Often, the budgets are scrutinized and the savings accounts questioned. Law libraries are seen as having resources beyond their yearly budget needs. The savings accounts are necessary because funding for the libraries comes from court filing fees. When a percentage of fees received is lowered, filings are down, inflation is up, and other expenses are incurred. These savings accounts are essential to keeping the law library functioning at a minimal level. It does. $1.20 per capita in Douglas County provides 22 service hours per week for attorneys and the public, over 105,000 people in an area larger than the entire state of Connecticut. Because of savings account the law library maintains, it has been able to sustain current print collection, offer limited computer services, and purchase necessary equipment and supplies, as well as utilize a professional librarian as a part-time staff member. The librarian is being fiscally responsible and saving for future needs. County law libraries provide access to justice by working with other community agencies to reach people in all walks of life and with varied legal information needs. Many county court librarians work closely with the courts and local legal aid offices to provide legal forms which may otherwise be difficult to find. They know what the resources are in their communities, And if the law library does not have the materials a person needs, the librarian can often direct that person to someone who can help. The county law library is often the place of last resort for many. All too often, my constituents are bounced from agency to agency, ending up at the law library frustrated and desperate. By knowing which agencies the person has been to and where other available resources are, the librarian is able to connect the person with correct resources. Sadly to say, there are times when there is truly no other place to send someone. It is vital for county law libraries with trained staff to exist to assist these constituents in locating even a small bit of material for their situation. Equal access to justice was vitally important to our founding fathers and continues to be an emphasis of our courts. County law libraries play a crucial role in access to justice for each member of its community, regardless of their status, case, or income level. Without the county law libraries, there's often nowhere for people to turn for information on their legal issues, now more than ever due to these troubled economic times. County law libraries and their neutral position in an adversarial system are vital to equal justice for all, which is a cornerstone of our democracy. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, Chairman.
Thank you, Mick, Commissioner. Any questions for Commissioner Lawrence?
And once again, I would defer those questions to Diana Hadley, my library.
I do have one question. Regarding the services that you subscribe to, the vendors that are electronic, such as Westlaw, can you give us a ballpark of what your cost is?
My name is Diana Hadley, for the record, and Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I pay approximately $100 a month. I received a contract with Westlaw in the late 90s, and the contract no longer exists. So if I were to go out for a contract again, I would probably be paying considerably more. They have chosen to honor and just recently raised my costs slightly, but they have chosen to honor my existing contract. However, that does not allow public access. It is for my use only.
Okay. And does it have a limitation as to how many hours or?
$100 a month gives me 20 minutes of time.
Okay.
Just 20 minutes of time. If I go over that, then they charge me accordingly.
Thank you.
Any other questions for either the commissioner or for Ms. Hadley? Representative Harker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. From what I'm learning here, I don't know if the county law libraries function tightly enough that to even consider this question, but can there be
Representative,
savings?
You need to move the mic closer. Sorry, thank you. I'm wondering if there can be any savings realized by negotiating these rates with the online services as a group, or if this is already happening. It sounds to me like it's not, but is this something that is feasible?
It is something that the Oregon Council of County Law Libraries, we have talked about several times. And it is something that we are looking into. There are several members of the council here today. Each county at this point, because print, as Jackie Jerkins pointed out, print is often tied to your online services. It varies from county to county, and unfortunately at this point, every county does things so differently. They have very, very different budgets. I mean, currently sitting in the audience, we have Benton County, Corvallis, which is open 12 service hours a week. We have Multnomah County, Clackamas County, Washington County, which are open far more hours a week. We're only open 22 hours a week. Marion County and Lane County open other hours. There's so much variation between the counties. There are only three staffed law libraries with law librarians active in our organization east of the Cascades. So trying to negotiate a large package is challenging at best.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Commissioner and Ms. Hadley. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Those are the only names I was furnished as people who wanted to testify, and I recognize we have other people in the audience who are from other counties. We've gotten, I think, some good information from couple of counties now. Is there anybody who wanted to come and present who has something that would amplify on what was what we've already heard? Yes, sir.
Thanks very much, Chair McPherson. Chair Brzezinski, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm the Intergovernmental Relations Manager for Lane County. And I didn't intend to testify, but I did want to give the committee just a little bit more context. It struck me when your chair of Douglas County, Commissioner Lawrence, was here. He indicated to you that he'd been in Washington, D.C. last week lobbying for secure rural schools. Anybody who listened to the radio today probably heard that we were sort of went from elation to deflation this week in terms of county funding. On Tuesday, Senate passed a package that included a full reauthorization of county funding. Yesterday, the House completely eviscerated that package, and county funding is not in the headlights at all right now. Congress is scheduled to adjourn tomorrow. You know, counties are in a world of hurt, and Douglas County and Lane County, which I represent, are both identified as hard-hit counties due to our reliance on timber payments. This is something that I think members will expect to see, is that counties will be here quite a bit this coming session, not to ask for a bailout, but certainly to ask for the ability to maintain our programs without imposition by the legislature. And this is an example of, I think, a good example of where we really need your assistance to maintain programs. You know, one thing that I've really been struck with since I've worked for Lane County is we don't choose our customers. We get people who come into counties for assistance in the arenas of public health, in the arenas of public safety, in the arenas of assistance for dealing with law, who have no place else to turn, and we don't turn those people away. This is their access point. We'd urge you to allow us to maintain the programs as they've been in the past. I think the irony here really is that, think about the people on the other side of the case from the Collection Association. A lot of the disenfranchised, low-income people who may have gotten into trouble economically, we can expect there's going to be more of those people in the future. This is the assistance that they need. This is the assistance they get from these law libraries. And I just urge you to remember the plight of counties as we sort of move forward into a new era for counties. Thank you.
Very good. Any questions for Mr. Kyler?
No question for Mr. Kyler, but I do have a statement. I think one of the things, if Mr. Taylor could maybe work on this, is to looking at how we might be able to do better at the state level with the counties. And specifically, I'm wondering if the state library, if they have these services available, and if they do, is there some way that we can actually help provide these services at the county level through the state? I don't know if that's how these vendor contracts work, but that's something I think that maybe we should be looking at as being a little bit more creative.
Mr. Chairman, as the Committee of Senate presents, I could call the state librarian. I could also bring in the Oregon State Bar, and we could meet with a representative of the county libraries and probably brainstorm as to what services are available and possibly, I think Representative Parker mentioned, purchasing in bulk, whether they could do that. I know the Bar has its own research program, too, that it's put together. It's more limited than Lexis and Nexus and Westlaw, but I believe it's considerably less expensive.
Okay, well, we're all the time, in fact, more than the time that we have allotted on our calendar. This was in response, of course, to the budget note. There was no action to be taken. Just speaking as one member of the two committees, I would urge the county law librarians to continue to move forward with electronic access and some of the traditional treatises, for example, that were stocked on library shelves, which are a pretty expensive way to go. And I would urge you to, as I know you already are, to be making careful decisions about whether that's the best allocation of resources as opposed to a broader electronic access for both lawyers and for the public in delivering this important service. That concludes the portion of our information meeting on county law libraries. We'll now move on to the next item on the agenda, which is an update on Project Clean Slate. We have Roy Jay, the founder of the Clean Slate Project and president of the African American Chamber of Commerce with us today. Mr. Jay.
Good morning, Chair Krasinski, Chair McPherson. How are you? And all of my legislators that I'm giving tax dollars to. I'm grateful for the opportunity to be here early this morning. And for the record, my name is Roy Jay. I'm president and CEO of the African American Chamber of Commerce. But more importantly, I run a program called Project Clean Slate. And for those of you that have not had a chance to listen to us in the past, I'll give you a little bit of history. Back in 2007, I was banging on doors here at the state capitol with my little sob story about how we had to do something for a lot of folks in this, not only in our community but throughout the entire state, that were facing a lot of barriers to employment, barriers to housing, barriers to other opportunities because of suspended driver's license, minor criminal convictions, things that are preventing them from being productive citizens. You listened. You acted. And I'm here to give you an update, not just about how great the program is. You know, we brought folks that are going through the program, people that have been through the program, so you can see how our tax dollars are being spent on a program that started from no place and went to show place, and we have now received national attention all over the country, and this is just the beginning. To my left is Joe Nunn, who is the program administrator for Project Clean Slate. To my right is Diane Grover, a private attorney who's stepped in to also help out with some of this. And then we have those of you that know me know that I can't show up without bringing a video, part of my home movies, just so you'll see exactly how this program has progressed. But more importantly, we've got four individuals that are going to be with us today, and they are going to also give you a little bit of their stories. And I realize that we are tight on time. Linda, how are you?
Well.
Good. I like the outfit. So, but I could get up here and tell you about all the wonderful things we're doing. We started out with what we considered seed money that you guys were gracious enough to grant to us through the help of Representative McPherson and Representative Chip Shields and a bunch of other folks here. And we've sort of grown this money a bit. We've tried to leverage it as much as possible. Also in the audience, I think if he's behind me, is Matt Greenhide. If he'll raise his hand, this is the guy that keeps an eye on our money to make sure that everything is going to be in checks and balances. We use coupons, we use discounts, we use anything that we can do to make sure this thing is going to run. The unfortunate part about this program, and there is an unfortunate part, but it's good and it's bad. There is more demand than what we can even handle. Let me repeat. There is more demand than what we can even handle. We are only operating in Multnomah County. We are busting at the seams right now with people that need for us to come into other counties. They all have problems, regardless of what zip code you live in, what your lifestyle is. Everybody seems to have a problem, and it's not just in one particular area of Northeast Portland. We've had a lot of help and success from the police department, the district attorneys, the various social service agencies, child support, especially the Department of Motor Vehicles, which has been very grateful in helping people get back into society. This is not a get-out-of-jail-free card by any means. People that go through this program, when they go through Joe's program at these workshops, must be ready to change their lives. They must be ready to be contributing members of society, pay taxes to our general fund so they can get on with their lives. So I have allergies today, but that's what happens when you turn 81. So I want to take some time. I'm going to sort of step back, and I want to introduce, in order of testimony, Angela D'Esposito. John McGinnis, John Jeske, and Bruce Melvin, who are going to take about 2 minutes of your time each to tell you their stories, and then we're going to show the home video, and then we're going to get into some Q&A, if that's okay with you. Okay? So, okay, let's... Okay.
Good morning. My name is Angela D'Esposito, and I'm 39 years old. I volunteered to be here this morning to tell you about my experience with Project Clean Slate. I was working for a nonprofit in Portland called Central City Concern, and it was suggested to me by my director that I have some criminal charges and I had a suspended driver's license, and that I look into Project Clean Slate, and I did. And I feel like for me that was the beginning of where I've come to now. At that point I had a suspended driver's license for about a year and a half, and I had multiple criminal charges from my addiction from 1999. And from the time I entered Project Clean Slate, I went through their class. Joe Nunn made a big impact for me. He talked about goals and the changes that we need to make in our lives. And at that point in time, I didn't have my GED. So for me, I feel like the beginning was Project Clean Slate. I was able to do my community service, get some fines taken care of, and get my driver's license back. And I felt like it made me more marketable in the employment industry, and it also gave me hope. And from there, I got my GED. I went back to school. I got my CEDC1, and so I'm a certified alcohol and drug counselor. And now I also did an internship, and I helped develop an intensive outpatient treatment program, which if I didn't have my driver's license, I wouldn't be able to transport the clients that I was working with to and from detox or to appointments they needed to go to, or to an inpatient treatment center out at the coast. And I feel like if it wasn't for Project Clean Slate, I wouldn't have that driver's license. And also, I'm back working for Central City Concern and as an employment specialist case manager. And I work with people with addiction issues and barriers to employment. And most of my customers and clients, I refer to Project Clean Slate because of what it's done for me, and hopes that they will have the same opportunity. And I've just seen it change people's lives, and it really changed my life a lot. And I feel like it's an amazing, amazing opportunity. So thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Cito.
Hi, my name is John McGinnis. I'm 38, and I lost my license when I was 18, and got in a hole, kept driving, and I always had a chip on my shoulder where, you know, I didn't steal, or I didn't do drugs. I never felt like I was, you know, that bad guy, but I was in and out of jail just like all those other guys, and all I did was drive. I felt like I was wrong, but it was, I didn't realize how great it was to have a driver's license, and then I've never had one in my whole life, so basically. And for 17 years I did that, and about 3 years ago I quit driving and started trying to pay off all these little towns all over the state that I owed money to. And when I landed in Multnomah County, they told me I owed $14,000 for I think 30 driving while suspended over 10 years apparently. So they also told me about Project Clean Slate, and at this time I already have a great job. I'm Monday through Friday, I'm doing great, and I was hoping that I could get my license someday. And turns out, and here in a few months, for the first time in my life, basically, I'm going to drive to my parents with a license and insurance for just doing community service for the next, well, a lot of weekends of community service. But a lot of weekends. I work during the week, and then I'm going to do my community service, and it's going to be great. I'm, you know, almost 39, and I'll finally have my driver's license, and I'll quit breaking the law. So, And it's been a great thing for me. And it's too good to be true when they told me about it. And so when I showed up and talked to Joe, and I just couldn't believe it. So that they actually have that. And so I'll be legal. So
terrific. Thank you, Mr. McGinnis.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is John Jeska. I'm 35 years old, and I came down here this morning with Project Clean Slate to tell you my story. Excuse me. I think that I'm probably one of the people that you guys would hope could change, because statistically I shouldn't be here. After 6 incarcerations as an adult and a couple as a juvenile, I'd become institutionalized. I'd never really held a job down before, paid child support, taxes, or drove with a license. Usually within 90 days of me being released from prison, I was either back out on the run or I was reincarcerated. Adding the fact that I was a drug addict, there wasn't any hope of me getting my life together. During my 6th and last incarceration in 2006, I was placed in the alternative incarceration program at the Powder River Drug Treatment that you guys have funded in the Department of Corrections. No other time in any of my incarcerations have I been so influenced to change my life. That program opened my eyes to all the problems that I had with the way that I thought and taught me the tools to deal with them. For the first time, I came out of prison a better man than when I went in. But I came out with only having the set of clothes that I had and a pair of shoes to my name. Soon after my release, I went to the Southeast Works one-stop career center in Portland, where I attended employment classes and learning how to make a resume. They also helped me with clothes and work tools. Within a week, I got a job and have not been unemployed since. Fortunately, it would only take me just $600 for me to get my license. So I have a license for the first time in 33 years. I pay taxes, and I don't break the law. I've become the man that my father brought me up to be. I'm a father of a 12-year-old daughter. She wants braces, and I want to buy a house someday. I would like to have credit one day for my daughter, for if my daughter wants to go to college, then I can co-sign a loan. However, as of right now, I can't even rent an apartment, and I've never been evicted from anywhere. I have no unpaid bills or credit card debt, no repossessions or any foreclosures. I am so far in debt right now because of the court fines from the record of my past. During my incarceration, I had many people say that they saw no point in getting a taxpaying job when they got released because they owe so much in restitution and court fines. They complained that it made no sense to put huge fines on people that have no history of making an honest living in the past. And if and when they did get their life together, chances are they will get something close to minimum wage, living paycheck to paycheck, barely being able to survive, let alone pay on a $5,000, $10,000, or maybe even $30,000 court restitution. Most who tried to get their lives together failed from discouragement when it looked hopeless to get out from under this debt. I myself owe $10,000 for crimes that I was sent to prison on. I never really had a job before, so I started under $10 an hour. With the $10,000 I owe in back child support I accumulated while incarcerated, it looked like it would be 10 years before I got out of debt. Then I heard of Project Clean Slate. I filled out an application, and after a year I was called. With my commitment to better my life and become a productive member of society, Project Clean Slate is helping me to convert some of what I owe into doing things to benefit my community. This couldn't help me more. It's a tremendous amount of weight lifted off of my shoulders. Although I'm not completely debt-free, I can actually see the light at the end of the tunnel. If it wasn't for the help of Project Clean Slate, I could pretty much forget about braces for my daughter or buying a house before she's 18. And just getting this help has boosted my confidence and gives me more encouragement to get the other debts paid off soon so I can live the American dream. This program has helped people get their licenses back years before they ever would have been able to without it, giving people a better chance at getting higher paying jobs and providing the security of having transportation for their families. It also encourages people to do better when there is evidence that life can treat you good when you're doing the right thing. And I know it has for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eska.
My name is Bruce Melvin, and I'll be 48 October the 1st. And I'm volunteering at the to let you know about my experience from Clean Slate. I moved to Oregon in 2000 from Florida. And I had recovery when I moved here. And I stayed clean about 2 years, and I had suffered a relapse on alcohol. And I got behind on my insurance payments, and eventually my license came up suspended. And like a smart guy like me, I thought I could get away with, you know, driving with no insurance. And I got pulled over about two or three times and wound up having debts, you know, that I couldn't pay. And by trade, I'm a detailer. I'm a car detailer, and I got 20 years experience in detailing cars. So when I go, you know, from here to there, it's good for me to have license so I can get to a customer to detail a car, you know. And I'm very good at what I do. I got 20 years in it, and I do boats, yachts, RVs, limousines, and things of that nature. And it was a real setback when I collected up $3,200 in fines with a guy like me that didn't have an income. And Project Clean Slate rescued me from that. And it really helped me a lot. I'm back in AA, and I got 2 years and two months recovery now. And I earned the respect of my family and stuff like that. I got a brother, a school superintendent. He came up to Oregon and visited me last week, and he stayed with me for about 5 or 6 days, and that's a blessing to me with my background to have him back in my life. And I owe that all to recovery and Project Clean Slate. And I think recovery and Project Clean Slate goes together, hand in hand, because when a person gets clean and sober, it's time for him to have a break and a chance in life. And a lot of time, the wreckage of your past, in the back of people's minds, they think that, well, he always fall down in this thing, so I ain't going to give him a break. And you get discouraged, and sometimes you go back to drinking because you're still into that mold, even though you're clean and sober. I can't get a break. But Project Clean Slate gave me a break, and it helped me with my family life, got them back in my life, and it got me to be able to move around and do cars again. So I'm very grateful for what Project Clean Slate done for me. I never had a felony or anything like that. That's probably why I'm not on parole and I was able to come to Oregon with this accent. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate all of you coming today. It's been quite inspiring to hear your life stories. I know it's difficult to describe the challenges you've faced in the past, but it appears you're overcoming them very well. Before you're excused, are there any questions for any of these witnesses? Oh, very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is typical. We didn't bring them here for you to cry or anything else, but this is typical. And they're coming from every zip code you can imagine, but they're only coming to one county right now. We have over 18,000 people that have inquired trying to get into Project Clean Slate. I mean, what you see here in back of the office is a staff of a very limited number of people that are working beyond you can even imagine the hours that we put in. But this is not about just giving somebody back a driver's license. This is not about just saying, bless you, my son, and go on your way and get another ticket. We look at people as being not, how do I put it, they're clients. They're not defendants. They've already been down that road, and you know, maybe nobody here has ever went through the DMV problem, and I want to explain to you that 90% of the people coming in through Project Clean Slate all have one issue. They need to get their driver's license back. Now, they're coming out of prison. They could be working in offices downtown. I mean, you cannot imagine. We have people from law enforcement families that are enrolled in this program because they've got friends, relatives, everybody else that's going through this problem, and a lot of things people never want to talk about. So we're busting at the seams, and we've basically outgrown it. We knew what we were getting into. But every day, it's a different challenge. We're dealing with people from high end folks in nice neighborhoods to people that have mental health problems to people that just have never had a license in 35 years. In 35 years, they have been driving these streets. So what I want to do, though, because I realize that we're on a time thing, you need to see the video. You need to see what our money is being spent for. thing. So it's only 8 minutes and 8 minutes and 40 seconds, but it's definitely worth it. So if everything goes right, there's always going to be some kind of technical difficulties, and if so, then we'll blame it on Gary Oxley.
Is a man rebuilding his life.
I think it's good. And I feel great, you know, and I really don't want to relapse, because if I was to relapse, the same thing would happen over and over.
For many years, Bruce Melvin broke the law. Addicted to alcohol and drugs, he lost his license, but kept on driving.
If I take back streets, most of the time I don't run into the police. Or I take the interstate, because I'm moving fast and he going on about his business and stuff like that, and trying to watch my speed.
Melvin was unwilling to face his addictions, but that only made things worse.
We saw that domino effect of suspending, getting caught on suspension like, before you know it, you got a pile of suspensions, and then you buried alive, you know, and you'll never be able to get them back.
When he finally came around to reforming his life, it was nearly impossible to do it alone. Then Melvin heard about a program called Project Clean Slate.
Well, that was so good about the Clean Slate program, that they give you one chance, that you can get a second chance to get back on track.
But your attitude will determine your altitude. You understand this?
The man leading the charge behind Project Clean Slate is Portland, Oregon entrepreneur Roy Jay. Inside the Multnomah County Courthouse, Jay lays ground rules for those interested in the program.
Be prompt, be on time, and the classes that you're going to go through are going to be able to help you.
Jay explains that Project Clean Slate can forgive minor criminal convictions, reorganize child support payments, even forgive thousands of dollars in traffic fines, all for participating in a responsibility class and doing community service.
And this does not cover parking tickets. Yes, sir.
But by far the most important outcome for participants is getting back their driver's license.
Without a driver's license, and you have child support, you can't even get a license to do nails. You can't be a barber. You can't be a doctor. You can't be an attorney. You got this stuff hanging on you.
Right. Okay. Right.
Jay is a charitable, well-connected businessman. He wanted his friends in the African-American business community to do something significant, and then the idea came to him all at once.
You know, it changes lives because too many people were living in shadows.
Jay received cooperation from police, judges, parole officers, people from across the legal spectrum. He sold them the clean slate idea. And as you can see from all the good press decorating his office walls, it's been a hit.
It's not just about me. I may have had the idea, but if I didn't have the right people on the team, then guess what? That's all it became, was just another great idea. But we have the right people on the team because I live in Portland, Oregon.
What I really like about this program is that it embodies those kinds of characteristics that I try to live my own life.
Portland City Commissioner Randy Leonard has helped push the idea through City Hall and secure some funding.
Yeah, we have to deal with people that break the law, but there are smarter ways to deal with it than just throwing them in jail or permanently having this kind of black cloud exist over their head.
Leonard says he's willing to accept the fact that some participants will not reform after going through the program.
They may calm the system and get one offense dealt with, but if they're thinking like that, they'll be back in front of a judge soon.
And judges sold on Project Clean Slate say it just makes sense.
I have signed orders dismissing fines of $15,000 that people have come and did their community service, paid back the community went to DMV, got the license, got reinstated.
Multnomah County has tens of thousands of outstanding warrants and something like $190 million worth of outstanding fines.
Circuit Court Judge Edward Jones says getting people to accept some responsibility for their mistakes is better than leaving them where they're at.
Let's pull people back across the line into an organized life. Have them pay some taxes.
And in Judge Jones's experience, the county will never recover the millions in outstanding fines.
And if we can trade that uncollectible money for some community service or even just some classes or participation in a drug program or getting your GED, we're way ahead.
He's just one really good chief.
One of those caught in the cycle of addiction and facing big legal fees was Tina Velasquez. Even when she wanted to change, it was nearly impossible.
It looked like a huge mountain to climb. It looked like the Alps.
Velasquez, though, took the opportunity she received from Project Clean Slate and did something amazing.
I feel like I was born to do this work.
What?
Because I lived it.
After completing the Clean Slate program, she has a new job. Velasquez helped people with criminal records find work.
You know, this is actually the first job I've ever held in my life. And, and I'm a single mother of two kids.
On her desk are photos of her children, kids she used to be separated from because of her drug addiction.
I went to jail for everything from possession to distribution to theft.
Velasquez says she used to be notorious, arrested over and over, and known by law enforcement.
They used to call me the warrant lady because I never used to report years ago.
Now, though, she can support her family. She's even done public speaking in front of local leaders. She has a car, her first one ever, and her driver's license. Velasquez is once again in contact with those probation and parole officers, but this time, it's to help her clients find work.
Instead of feeling apart from the community, I feel a part of the community.
There's just an overwhelming need for something like Clean Slate. District Attorney Mike Schrunk says while the county has tried a similar forgiveness program in the past, Project Clean Slate really took off. 3,000 people lined up to enroll on the first day it was available.
It was like a light bulb going on. We thought, my gosh, there's a bigger need out here than even we imagined.
Now Schrunk wants to see other counties adopt similar programs.
And we have an opportunity to get men and women, citizens of this community, going the right direction.
So we just basically tell them, it's on you. And if you're really serious, we see you're serious. So we're going to support you and we'll be there for you.
Former teacher Joe Nunn coordinates the Clean Slate program. On this day, Clean Slate organizers found potential clients at a community fair.
That has to start with the faith that I can do something different. And no matter how people look at me or judge me, I can be somebody different if I'm determined.
So you need to learn to manage money. That's the bottom line.
Once clients are signed up, they attend a class with Nunn to learn about personal responsibility.
Well, I'm supplying you with people that are trying to give you some tools, trying to help you get back to work.
In the class, they also hear from business people about how to get a job.
How many of you have done an interview for last year?
And they listen to banker Mary Edmonds about how to become financially sound and improve their credit.
You may think that you don't have any credit. You may be surprised.
Edmonds says some people take the class very seriously. One person who has stood out is Greg Ivory. He's working to change after his past addictions.
It's a long process, and it's not a really fun process. There's a lot of hard work involved, and he's been really great at doing that.
Ivory now has a credit card, insurance on his car, and a driver's license. Not only that, he's training to become a truck driver.
This just makes me feel like I'm part of society.
People in the classes listen closely. They see that this is something they don't want to mess up.
It seems like most of the jobs that I will apply for, they ask for a current driver's license, and I don't have one.
I can't get jobs. I can't get kid jobs. I can't get anywhere.
Matt Wheeler says he spent almost 2 decades in prison. And with no license, he faces a dead end.
I've never had an armed driver. Never. I'm 43 years old. I'll be 44 in July. I never had one.
Wheeler sees this as a way out, a way to work and create the life that his past addictions prevented.
I have no Social Security. I have nothing. My future is in my hands to do something with it, to get something for my future, for my retirement. If I don't do it, there ain't nobody to do it.
It's an incredible collaboration.
Lynn Knox for the City of Portland says Clean Slate's success is not due to the program alone, but also because of valuable partnerships. Partnerships created and financially supported by agencies such as the City of Portland's Bureau of Housing and Community Development. Knox appreciates the work of Clean Slate leaders.
They are efficient, they are serious, and they engage people very strongly in the work that they're doing.
I was this drug court judge for a couple of years.
Once a Clean Slate participant finishes responsibility classes and community service, he or she stands before a judge. Judge Jones keeps things light. He's proud that people want to do better for the sake of the community, their families, and themselves.
And by the way, good work.
Bruce Melvin's quit looking for trouble. Now that he has his license, he's looking for work.
It was like a weight lift off of my chest, and freedom arrived.
Freedom to do as he wishes, a far-reaching freedom that impacts everything.
A woman don't want to catch the bus with you to the movies when you're 47, 45, and 46 years old. So, you know, it does a lot for you, you know. It brings your integrity back into your life. Self-esteem starts to get a little better.
Melvin is not sure where he'd be without Project Clean Slate, but it wouldn't be any place good. Now, he has a new life.
There's a lot of people out there that's really ready. That's really ready to make that transformation.
Let me give you another quick note. Last year, 125,000 Oregon driver's licenses were suspended, according to DMV as of December. 125,000. A lot of those people are construction workers. A lot of those people are people that live in your neighborhood. A lot of those people are just honest, hard-working folks that had some things happen to them. They need to get back to work. They want to contribute to society. So with that said, I won't go into a whole lot of long oratory, but I'll be glad to answer any questions that you might have. And what answers I don't have, then we'll just have somebody else answer for you.
I would like to tell the committee that, just to clarify a little bit, you saw businesses who helped support us. Enterprise is one of them. You saw that they help us with interview services and showing how people what the interviewer is looking for and what the interviewee needs to do. It's been some great information that's helped some of our people get jobs. Also, Albina Community Bank through Mary Edmeads. We talk about consumer counseling services, the services you pay for, and then we bring Mary in. She does a talk about debit, credit, identity theft, establishing her credit. And when she gets done, I ask the group, okay, how much is she going to charge you? And they realize that somebody's doing something out of their heart. Albina Community Bank can't commit money to us, but they can commit resources, and that's what we've been able to do. So we have people who get to see up front what businesses are looking for, and we've had a couple of people interview with Enterprise, and we also have the help of a private lawyer, Yolanda Watkins, who comes in and talks to people for an hour about their rights. And then Diane helps us with expungements. So we have a lot of people in Portland who are offering other services, and all of those people are willing to go tri-county, statewide with us as we grow. Thank you.
And Mr. Nunn, you didn't identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry.
So
I'm Joe Nunn, and I'm a career teacher, third-generation teacher in Portland, and I'm the project administrator with Clean Slate.
Thank you very much. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm just delighted you all are here. You've done a great job. Joe, as the administrator, has a very long tradition in his family of community service in my community. My question on the financial report, Matthew Greenheit, is he the board treasurer?
He is the board treasurer as well.
Okay. And right. Could you tell, just so that we get on the record, who the other board members are for the org?
Myself and Joe Nunn. And the treasurer.
Okay.
Correct.
Thank you. Senator, what's it?
Thank you, Jim McPherson. First, I apologize for coming in late. I'm sitting on the Ways and Means meeting this morning also, so it's...
Yeah, two jobs.
We're running up and down the stairs, working on a midsection. Mr. Jay, you're probably familiar with the interstate compact between motor vehicle divisions of the various states, that if one state has a hold or a suspension or a revocation on a license, all member states honor that revocation. And that has become a major problem with many folks, and we seem to have a group or a large sector of that affected group are veterans, are military veterans who have been moved from state to state and so forth. So if you have a hold on your license in Florida, you're now a member of the society here in Oregon or a resident of Oregon, you can't get a license in Oregon until you can get that expunged in Florida or any other compact state.
Correct.
And that, of course, becomes a huge economic block for many people. Is your organization addressing that issue?
No. I wish we could. Right now, we are addressing just situations that are born in Oregon, that have history in Oregon. We have people that come in from other states, and they say they've got a suspended license in Illinois and Washington and things of that nature. And unfortunately, those jurisdictions and legislative bodies have not thought enough to move forward like you folks have or like our county has. So this would have to be something addressed in those individual states and counties if they're going to allow people to be able to go through a Project Clean Slate. Now, keep in mind, though, that other states are already on our radar, or we are on theirs. Joe and I traveled to, I don't know, a number of states and talked to a number of groups and number of agencies and both federal and state agencies that are looking at similar programs like Project Clean Slate. But our commitment is to make sure that we take care of Oregon first before we start spreading our tentacles too far. Our commitment is to take care of people right here in Oregon. This is where it starts. This is where it ends. It may not be the answer that you're looking for, but, you know, this is my home.
Yes.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Any further questions?
Representative Shields. One last thing. The financial statements, I understand that you've been reporting also to the local public safety coordinating council. They've been well informed about your progress, both on outcomes as well as financially. And District Attorney Strunk has also been, kind of working with you on oversight issues.
Right. Yeah, and you'll see a letter in here from District Attorney Strunk. Keep in mind that, you know, we look at this as being seed money. Trust me, I know that the budget is tight. I know the state situation, but we're trying to come back, and we will be begging, because you can see that we're only one county and we need to expand. That, you know, we can't let people down, because this way you've heard the stories of only four of thousands of folks that are wanting to come back in and participate and pay taxes and be good citizens. And this is the best investment. This is not a basketball camp. It's not a golf tournament. We're investing in people in our state.
Very good. Representative Harker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Seems to be a fantastic program. I represent people in Washington County, and can you tell me who your contacts are there?
We are trying to get an audience with the district attorney and the presiding court judge. I mean, if you've got access to this, please help us. We have, and I don't want, just in the interest of time, these folks that you've heard from, they all have issues in Multnomah County. But a lot of folks still cannot, if they've got other issues in other counties, then it's still going to be on them because they can't get a job. So we've got a growing number of people from Clackamas County and Washington County, not to mention some of your own respective counties, Deschutes County, Marion County. I can go on and on and on where somebody's got some kind of ticket or they've got some kind of minor criminal thing. I'm not talking about major crimes, murder, robbery, rape. I'm sorry, we can't help you with that. That's between you, God, and Dr. Phil. But the rest of the folks... The rest of the people are looking for opportunity. And if we can get into these other counties, then the faster we can do it with more resources, then we are all better off. We are really better off. Okay?
I have a question. question.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. Hi, Mr. Jacobs.
How are you?
I'm great, thank you. And I did want to follow up on that because you're not in any other state, and you're not really beyond the Multnomah County area yet, but you're working on expanding in Oregon before you go to other states. Would that be correct?
Well, the first and foremost, as we've talked about it in our staff meetings and everything else that we've constantly publicized, this legislature, our city government, our county has been kind enough and nice enough to help us along. We never forget where we come from. We forget about all the pats on the back and nice accolades and all the publicity that we get. But we have to take care of our state first. You know, if everybody else wants to play follow the leader, but we have to take care of the folks here. If we have to lead by example, and Oregon has a reputation for that. You know, whether it be green bottle bill or anything else, people are still trying to figure out how can you guys do this? And this is not Chicago, Atlanta, New York, and Dallas. It's because, like I said in the video, this is my city, this is my state, and I'm proud of it.
And, Mr. Chair, I would say I've had many conversations with Mr. Jay, and he doesn't cut anyone any slack in the program. If you show up late, you're gone, and you don't get that second chance. So I appreciate that element to your program, because we're giving people a huge opportunity to get a second chance here, and you just can't be a slacker. It is time to knuckle down and be a responsible citizen of the state of Oregon, and I think you make that very clear.
You know, Senator Walker, I just want to also give a lot of credit to Joe, being a 31-year retired teacher and dealing with all aspects of education and students and things of that nature. And people ask us, why does this program work so well? Because it's not a typical program. We're not counting heads. We tell people, you will show up and your pants are not going to be sagging. You're not going to have jewelry hanging out here. You're not going to have a Mr. T starter set. We are not interested in any of that. And this is not what employers are looking for. Now, some folks may say it, and they might get sued, or somebody's going to file a discrimination case or something of that nature. This is a voluntary program. Our rules, this is the way you're going to come out of this thing, and we're going to make you better at the end. And there's nothing, and we've never had anybody say, oh, gee, I just didn't want to go to the program. You know, we've got a driver's license. We're going to help them out. But the whole idea is not only just to help them out, but help them become better people. Because, you know, as we tell them in classes, all they have to do is look at the newspaper, and there's no jobs for rap music artists, there's no jobs for basketball players, there's no jobs for people who just want to hang on the streets. And that's just not in our community, that's everywhere.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Just for the record, thank you all for being here, and I'm 59, but I made a major change in my life at age 35, mm-hmm. and that change came with an investment from the Student Scholarship Association in Oregon.
Yep.
I believe this morning that association asked the e-board for an additional $4 million. Mm-hmm. An additional $4 million. I believe very strongly that just because some of us have the potential to go on to higher education to get that change in our life, that's a good investment. It was a good investment for many people. But I wish we could have LFO do an assessment how much investment, this tiny little bit that we've put into these people, and the return for our income for the state of Oregon is huge. And so when you look at that fiscal impact, and much less the quality of life, I thank you.
Thank you.
Just for a moment, I'm Diane Grover. I'm a private attorney in Portland, and I work with the Project Clean Slate program. I provide reduce fee expungements for Project Clean Slate clients. And I just wanted to briefly say how proud I am to work with this program. As a former counselor who has worked with people going through the criminal justice system, I've seen firsthand what a difference a program such as this can make. And I believe this can truly be a model for other jurisdictions, other municipalities and counties. And again, I'm most proud working with this program, and I'm truly impressed with the quality of the clients. They are truly trying to make a big difference in their lives, and they're very serious about doing that. They're applying for nursing school. They're trying to get new job opportunities, going to college, even refereeing their own kids' soccer games. This they cannot do without the expungement process and some of the other services Clean Slate provides. So thank you again for giving us the opportunity to speak to you today. And again, I'm so proud to work with these gentlemen and the clients through the Clean Slate program. Thank you.
Representative Cameron, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Jay, thank you for showing us the update from last year. I'm concerned about individuals who would come. Obviously, their heart's in the right place. They want to make a change. And you run into literacy issues where we have people that are actually trying to learn how to get their credit and do these bank statements and stuff. And how do you handle that? What resources do you have available to you?
The only thing, and our resources are very limited, but and as Joe has explained, we rely on some of these volunteers and people that are on our team that have been on our team for several years. A lot of it is that we have to actually spend more time with them, making sure that they understand, number one, not only the credit situation, but also just basic community responsibility. The classes that they attend is called personal and community responsibility. That includes everything, including financial and how to be a better citizen and pay your taxes and being, as Diane says, being involved in your community and things of that nature. It's not an extended thing, but it's sort of a real abbreviated one size fits all until we can be able to get financial resources to expand and bring on other folks to be able to work with more people on a one-on-one. But it's a challenge because we've got material in various languages now. We're in various communities, and each one is highly unique, to say the least. Not everybody has a college degree, and I mean we have people that are in this program that have PhDs mm-hmm. that have hit hard times, and they get treated the same as the guy that had the third grade education.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And we are working with the courts right now to come up with a referral GED system so that if they would like to go to a specific institution to complete their education, like Angela did, we're trying to direct that as a Project Clean Slate affiliate program.
And they can do GED in lieu of doing other community service because what that does is that means that we have people coming out of Project Clean Slate with a education that they can at least qualify for a better job.
But if you don't get the GED, you don't get completed through Clean Slate.
Right. Very good. Well, Mr. Jay, Mr. Nunn, Ms. Grover, thank you very much for coming in and updating us on us. This is an exciting program. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay.
That closes ends the Project Clean Slate portion of our informational meeting. We'll move on then to the an oversight hearing on the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Not that I don't know. I'm doing the handling. Do the overview first. And all it is an oversight hearing, so that's great. I am.
We'll stand at ease for a moment while the until we can get to kind of the transition. But if we could Paul, that would help quiet the room. Call back to order the meeting of the Interim Judiciary Committees. We are now, we will proceed with the oversight hearing on the Office of Administrative Hearings, and we have Lane Shetterly here and Tom Ewing. Is that who we're going to begin with? I understand that we're open to however you want to introduce this to us, but I understood that the two of you might lead off.
No.
troubles.
Yeah, brings back memories. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committees. Good to see you all here in my favorite hearing room in this entire building. This is the most egalitarian hearing room in the entire building, where the witnesses and the committee are all on the same level. I like that. Pleased to be with you. My name is Lane Shetterly, former state representative, now just a country lawyer, except when I'm reforming our revenue system, which is happening even as we speak downstairs in hearing room F. But I'm pleased to be with you this morning to talk a little bit about the Office of Administrative Hearings. I'll let Tom introduce himself, and then, if you like, I can give you a little bit of background on the history of it. Tom can fill in, or vice versa, Mr. Chair, co-chairs, it's however you want to proceed.
And I'm Tom Ewing. I'm the Chief Administrative Law Judge for the Office of Administrative Hearings.
If you'd like, just a little bit of background on this. The Office of Administrative Hearings that exists today, embedded in the Employment Department, I was going to say began in 1997, and actually the history of this goes back many years before that. But when I came to the legislature in 1997, it was one of the priorities that I established for myself to see about creating at that point we called it a central panel for the conduct of contested case administrative hearings. The idea being, and it's I don't need to dwell on it, but the idea being that the perception out there that in the case of a contested case administrative agency hearing that you often have an agency which initiates an investigation that leads to an enforcement order that is then appealed to a hearing. That hearing is conducted in front of the very agency that did the investigation, issued the order, and then is decided by that agency. And there was at least a perception lack of fairness in that process, where this entire investigative charging and hearing function was being conducted within an agency. And so the purpose of House Bill 2948 in 1997 was originally to create an independent central panel of administrative hearing, administrative law judges to conduct these contested cases, to remove that function from the agencies and create a truly independent hearing process. That bill passed the legislature handily, but was vetoed by Governor Kitzhaber at the end of the session. Although in his veto message, Governor Kitzhaber did acknowledge the issues that had been identified by the bill, and I give him credit for directing that his office and the Department of Justice and agency directors work with the legislature during the interim for further review and to develop legislation for the 1999 session. And so that began the second effort toward this goal. It was a study group, more than a study group, an action group that involved me. Phil Schradl, who is here from the Department of Justice, was involved. David Schumann, who was Deputy Attorney General at the time, was the representative from the Department of Justice to the group. And so was Chip Lazenby from the governor's office involved in this. And then we also had a number of state agency representatives advising as we went. And that process developed what became House Bill 2525, which ultimately was introduced at the request of the governor. It became a governor's bill that created the central panel. The key components of House Bill 2525, I think, are important for historical purposes. In 1997, the effort was to create an independent central panel, independent standalone agency, basically. There were concerns about fiscal impact of that, and so in House Bill 2525, a compromise was struck, and you'll hear several compromises in House Bill 2525, because it was a grand compromise. And the compromise there was that rather than create a standalone hearings function, we would house it in the Employment Department. And the way that came about was that through this interim effort, we really uncovered that the Employment Department at that time was functionally acting as a central hearing panel for many agencies. It had hearing officers and so was doing hearings for several agencies. So we beefed that up, and we made the center, the panel an adjunct of the Employment Department. That led to another compromise because the concern about that was, well, from the legislature's perspective, that's efficient for budget purposes, but we also were concerned that this panel not be swallowed up within an agency and that it again lose its independence as subject as a division within an executive agency. And so the trade-off there to that compromise was the creation of the Oversight Committee that was created to oversee the operation of the of then the central panel and to provide basically a window for the legislature to continue to observe and monitor the operation and function of the panel. So that it didn't just become just get lost in the executive agency. So you have those two compromises there: one that we would house the panel within the Employment Department, but in doing so, we would create an oversight committee that would have the authority to oversee and make recommendations to the legislature in the event that recommendations would be forthcoming. Another key element of House Bill 2525 was in response to the earlier bill. In 1997, we created a panel. The idea was that we would create a panel with, I think, five or six agencies in it, as much as anything, to create a pilot program and hopefully through that prove the usefulness and efficacy of this central panel. So five or six agencies were identified as being within the central panel in 1997. The rest, boards and commissions, were excluded. In House Bill 2525, that was exactly reversed, and the default was that you're in unless you're excluded. And so House Bill 2525 was a much larger bill in terms of the number of agencies, boards, and commissions that were included. And in fact, there were, rather than specifying who was in the panel, the House Bill 2525 specified who was out. And there were some things about that that determined who was going to be in and who was going to be out. In one case, the Workers' Compensation Board department was left out because they already had a very well-settled structure of hearing officers, of administrative law judges, and a body of law and a process that was already so well in place, we frankly didn't want to touch that. We didn't include the corrections department, for instance, because frankly we didn't want to burden the hearings panel with objections about having to eat chunky peanut butter on sandwiches instead of creamy peanut butter, those kinds of things. That wasn't a big concern of the central panel. Also, we looked at agencies that did two-party cases as opposed to, one-party cases where the agency and a party are in contest with each other. Those were the ones that we were most concerned about. But again, by and large, the default there was agencies were included unless they were specifically excluded for some reason. So it made this panel, I think, off the bat, one of the largest in the country, if not the largest in the country, from the very first day. One of the other key compromises was in the issue of ex parte contacts. One of the concerns about the process before the panel was created that was that the Department of Justice advises the agency, and so you have this process of a hearing where the Department of Justice is advocating to the hearing officer, to the administrative law judge, and then when the hearing is over, you have the Department of Justice shifting roles and providing advice to the agency in how the case should be decided. And the concern about, again, the fairness that was at least suggested in that. And so ex parte contacts was an issue that we addressed in House Bill 2525. There, on the one hand, there was a suggestion that ex parte contacts should be treated as they are in court and they should be just prohibited, that there should be no ex parte contact between the Department of Justice or, frankly, the other side and the hearing officer. with the administrative law judge. Where we came down and the compromise there was that ex parte contacts would be permitted, but that they would have to be disclosed, and that an ex parte contact upon being disclosed would provide the other side an opportunity to respond. So at least that contact was being made apparent on the record, and that the party on the other side would have the opportunity to respond to the substance of that ex parte contact. Another issue, and I know it's before you in consideration, or at least it's proposed, the issue of final order authority. The compromise in House Bill 2525 was that the central panel would not have final order authority, that there was a sense that final orders in contested cases really represented a policy-making function of agencies, and that rather than dispossess them of that authority, we would not give the final order authority to the central panel. Rather, we would give them the authority to enter proposed orders unless agencies specifically delegated final order authority to the panel. And in, again, the compromise there being that in entering proposed orders, we would limit the extent to which an agency could then modify that proposed order. If it comes to factual issues, we said that if the order is based, if the agency is going to, that first of all, the agency could not change findings of what were called historical facts. That is, if a hearing officer heard testimony and made findings of historical facts, sort of was the light red or green at the time of the accident. Of course, that would come up in an agency hearing probably, but that's the kind of historical fact. That the agency would not be able to change a hearing officer's determination of those historical facts, well, unless I think they were not supported by
preponderance
of the evidence, that the agency could change predictive facts, which are more policy kinds of things, and emphasizing that if an agency makes a change in a proposed order, that it must identify the changes that it has made, so that again, it's transparent, and particularly for historical facts, we created a standard of review in the event of appeal to the Supreme Court, that the Supreme Court would get to review those historical facts de novo, and not be bound by the agency's redetermination of those historical facts. And so, just a bundle of compromises around that issue of proposed or final order authority. House Bill 2525 was created with a sunset in 2004. That sunset was extended during the 2002 special session until 2005, and then in 2003 in the legislative session after a joint legislative committee audit that reported very favorably on the first couple of years' history of the central panel, House Bill 2526 was introduced, which repealed the sunset entirely. It changed the title of the central panel to the Office of Administrative Hearings. It changed the title of hearing officers to Administrative Law Judge. And it altered the provisions for the chief ALJ, providing for a four-year term of appointment that would be terminable only for cause. And the effort there to be to provide some insulate that chief administrative law judge from influence by the agency, and to help ensure decisional and operational independence to that administrative law judge. And finally, House Bill 2526 continued the oversight committee on an ongoing basis. Originally, it was just set up to monitor the implementation of it, but now the Oversight Committee is on has a permanent charge, and included in that consultation role with the Director of the Employment Department in the appointment of the Chief Administrative Law Judge. So that, I'm sorry to bore you with that little history, but I think it's important for context. That gives you a sense of the four-year process that sort of birthed what we have today in the Office of Administrative Hearings. I think Tom is much more capable of by giving you testimony on how it's operating today, but clearly the effort, if you go back to it, was to provide a greater degree of confidence in the conduct of contested case administrative hearings in front of agencies, confidence on the part of particularly of citizens who were brought forward to these hearings, that they were getting a fair and independent hearing of their case and determination of their case. And then in the course of that, as I've described, several compromises that were intended to satisfy governor's concerns, agency's concerns, Department of Justice's concerns, as well as legislative interest in this. And I think in the classic case of legislative of lawmaking, those compromises were successful, I think, by in 2003 garnering almost unanimous legislative support for what became the final enactment of the Office of Administrative Hearings. And so certainly at that time anyway met legislative approval, and I think your function in terms of ongoing review is much like that of the Oversight Committee. As with anything else, I think these things are worth looking at from time to time to see if the compromises are holding, if the office is functioning the way it was intended. And so I commend you for taking time to look at it. I think it's a very important piece of government, and I'm glad that you're taking time to inquire into it.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair. Mr. Sherley, could you also comment on the historical genesis of the free peremptory challenge of the of an ALJ?
Yeah, I thank you, Mr. Chair, co-chairs Przanski and McPherson, Senator Whitsitt. This was the issue of challenging a hearing officer at the time, now administrative law judge, who's been assigned. Frankly, I remember that there was a compromise a lot better than I remember what the terms of that compromise were. Tom, you probably do as well. The idea being, again, going back to court process, if you have concerns about prejudice or independence of a judge to whom your case has been assigned, you have the ability to challenge that judge, and the presiding judge in the district can assign another judge to hear that case. We incorporated elements like that in the in House Bill 2525, and they were carried forward in 2526. I don't think we changed those in 2526. And if I may, I'll ask Tom. Like, see, I remember there was compromise around that. I can't remember where we landed.
I don't remember any compromise.
Is that right?
That was back in the discussions in 1999, and I wasn't party to those.
Tom, would you just ID yourself for you have it on the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I had already done that. I'm Tom Ewing. I'm the Chief Administrative Law Judge for the Office of Administrative Hearings.
I think you do.
Okay. Well, we hear from Mr. Ewing, and then we'll take questions from the committee's members.
Well, let me just say on a personal note, it's a pleasure sitting beside my friend Lane Shetterly. We did so appearing before this committee on several occasions back in 2003, so it's nice to revisit those that experience. I was going to talk and had been asked to talk about the history of the Office of Administrative Hearings, but as always, Lane does such a much better job than I can ever do, so I'm not going to go into that, and I'll be much more brief than I had intended to be, and just explain briefly the structure of the Office of Administrative Hearings to perhaps provide some context for you and any further discussions you have. You've heard the history. I have nothing really to add to that history. Regarding our current structure, we have 66 administrative law judges. We hear agency cases from about 75 to 80 different agencies. The subject matter which we hear is extremely diverse. Unemployment insurance claims, child support, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, Board of Medical Examiners, Boards of Tattoo Artists and Direct Entry Hearing Entry Midwives, Implied Consent, Financial Responsibility from the Division of Motor Vehicles. It is truly one of the, not only we perhaps, I think we're the second largest central panel in the nation. There is no central panel that has a broader jurisdiction than we do. We have offices principally in Tualatin, secondarily in Salem, and then in Eugene, and also very small offices for efficiency purposes in Medford and in Bend. I think on terms of our structure, that's probably what I'd like to say. Let me just conclude with the comment I have. And Lane had alluded to this. When Governor Kitzhaber back in 1997 vetoed House Bill 2948, he did so for two reasons. One, he was concerned about costs. And in 1999, the legislature was concerned about costs. In the year 2003, when there were discussions about making this permanent, there was discussion about costs. Let me address that briefly and say that from my own perspective, the legislature made a very sound decision, both in creating the Office of Administrative Hearings, setting aside the issue of independence and the appearance of a level playing field for citizens to adjudicate their disputes with agencies, but it made a sound fiscal decision. Over the last 9 years, we have eliminated 20 positions, and we're continuing to look for every efficiency and look at our FTE usage as well. And let me say, that wasn't over a period when workload diminished. It was over a period when workload actually increased by 16% on average every year over the first year that we came into existence in 2000. So from my own perspective, and clearly I'm, if you don't hear any passion in my voice, I can tell you there's plenty of it, an advocate for the Office of Administrative Hearings, not only for the principle that Lane Shetterly and others promoted and believed in and that I believe in, that is equal-handedness in agencies adjudicating disputes with citizens, but also in doing so in a way that is makes economic sense for taxpayers. So with that, I have nothing further to say, unless I'm happy to take questions, of course.
Mr. Ewing, it seems to me there's a tension between the efficiency that comes with having expertise build up in a certain individual or small group of individual ALJs and the desire to avoid the natural sort of connection and perhaps advocacy for the mission of the agency that builds up. To what extent do the same individual ALJs serve a particular agency and build up that expertise but also relationships? And to what extent do you assign new ALJs who don't have that background but also those relationships that might affect the decisions they make?
That's an excellent question. And one of the most difficult problems that I have faced in 9 years. When we started on January 1, 2000, we were the consolidation of 7 formerly independent agency hearing units. And so all of these ALJs transferred into the OEH. Some of them had axes to grind against the agencies that had formerly employed them. I noticed, too, that some, unintentionally, tended to buy in to agency arguments that on sort of more neutral review, I think were sort of questionable positions that agencies took. So, but everybody who came into the OEH, I can say, was as passionate as I was about providing a level playing field. Over the years, what we've done is the following. First of all, those problems do not exist with our own OEH hires. We purposely have designed a training program that, without sacrificing the efficiency that comes with specialization, to have ALJs train in more areas. So that kind of connection, that kind of ownership that you're rightly talking about, because it has occurred, has been seriously diluted. And then through other things such as peer review and not least continuing whenever opportunity I get or the managers or other ALJs within our OAH to emphasize our mission, which is to be independent and impartial in our decision making. I have seen, I don't see that anymore like I used to see it 9 years ago. So it's been through, in summary, it's been through training, it's been through internal advocacy, and it's also been through having ALJs do different kinds of programs so they don't become invested in that program as I saw 9 years ago.
Mm-hmm. If I could, Representative McPherson, interestingly, that issue of expertise was actually one of the arguments against the panel, in that there was benefit in having hearing officers who were familiar with the law and the issues, and that was used actually against enactment of the bill, that we would dilute that, we would lose that. And I think the counter-argument to that is that expertise is a good thing, but we would rather have independent experts than experts who are employed by the agency. And so I think we, although it's still a live issue, just because you have those relational things, I think we have gone a long ways toward addressing that.
Yep. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for being here. I wonder if you could address, I believe, Mr. Shetterly, you said that it was House Bill 2526 in which the terminology was changed from hearings officer to ALJ. And I wonder if you could talk, either both or both of you could talk a little bit about the reasons for that change and some of the discussions that went on in there. And then also if you could explain who are the people who are the ALJs, what is their background? Thank you.
If I'll take the first question and let Tom take the second. Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Senator Bonamici, I'm sorry. Facetiously, I said once that we changed the title from hearing officer to ALJ because we couldn't give them a pay raise. I think the truth is that over time, ALJ had become, on a national basis, the more common title for that function. And so we were trying to make sure that our Office of Administrative Hearings was consistent and seen on par with other states and within the federal government too, their cadre of ALJs that perform the same kind of functions in overseeing agency cases. So that really was behind the change in terminology, just to make us consistent with what was evolving, and not only out of state but in state too, already at the workers' compensation department, as I mentioned, they already had the title ALJ, and it was serving largely the same function. So that was largely just to unify the terminology.
And I can tell you that I was relieved to have it because the acronym Hearing Officer Panel is HOP. And so I was chop of the hop, and there were a number of other funny little play on words. So I was very relieved to be done with that. Let me answer, Senator Bonamici, your second question. When I took this job 9 years ago, 9 years ago then and 9 years later, I realized that hiring was the most important thing I could do. My own experience was 9 years ago that overall the hiring standards were, for the most part, non-existent. There were a lot of people who were not attorneys. I do believe that since we're in the business of law, to do justice to both agencies and citizens who appear before us, we have to have some kind of legal training and formalized legal training. And so what I instituted back in the year 2000 was a screening device for hiring that is very, very high. We hire on a permanent basis 1 out of every 9 applicants. We require them to submit writing samples on fact situations that I myself write with law that I provide. We review them anonymously. And so the old problem of hiring people that frankly were not able to really do the kind of writing at the level that, or legal analysis at the level that I thought was necessary, that ended. And then trial service, we took trial service extremely seriously. It has interested me how some people who have come to work for us on a trial service level have excellent backgrounds, excellent credentials, very, very thoughtful and talented men and women in the law. But they can't make a decision. And they can't deal with the high volume of cases that we have because administrative law is truly go, go, go. And you can't second guess yourself. And unlike the judicial branch, you can't wait to get 100% of the facts. Sometimes necessarily you have to make decisions on something less. So through a hiring practice that I've been, frankly, very, very proud of and hasn't changed in 2 years, didn't need to be changed, 1 out of 9 becomes a permanent employee of us. They are all attorneys, not because we're only picking attorneys, but that's because only attorneys with formal legal background and training are able to get through the hiring process that we have, hiring and evaluation.
And Mr. Ewing, are they full time? The people you hire, then that's their sole occupation is serving as ALJs?
That's correct, sir.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, can you talk to me a little bit about the role of commissions and boards of agencies who have these administrative roles, and then there's a decision by one of these ALJs, and it comes back for some type of affirmation from them when they're going to take an action based on that then? Or is that's the legal thing that they're going to use as the basis to impose a penalty? And the reason I'm asking that, when I was on the Board of Forestry, we had one come back. I totally, absolutely disagreed with it. There was no justice in it. But we were working on consensus. He sat there for an hour trying to convince me they were right. Venetia, we just voted. But is there a relationship with those decisions from the LAJ come back as a basis for a agency action then against that person?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Krieger, I think the answer to that, and then I'll ask Tom to fill in because he's seen this more than I have. You do have the ALJ enter a proposed order that goes back. You've got some agencies that have provided final order authority or
most
some commissions?
Most.
Okay. So in those that have not delegated final order authority, that order then goes back to the agency or the commission if there's a board that oversees for review. And my understanding is that the process by which that is reviewed and that board or commission really is a function of how that board or commission operates. You mentioned by consensus or whether it's some other manner or whether it's an agency director that does it. I think how that happens within the agency is really a matter of how the agency itself is organized. What House Bill 2526 says is, regardless how you get there, agency, if you're going to modify that order, which you may do, you may disagree with it and say we're kicking it back and we're not kicking it back, we're just going to change it. You at least have to show your work so everyone knows what has transpired from that ALJ's decision to the final order through the agency. But how that gets done, I think, is really a function of how the board or commission operates internally.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Krieger, I'll try to answer the question the best I can, and maybe with your permission, enlarge on it a little bit, because as I understand, there is present before you or pending a discussion about final order authority. And if I put this in the context not simply of Oregon, but of other central panels, after all, I don't know that we need to reinvent the wheel to explain to you what other states have done on this very issue. But to explain the process, what will happen is that the OEH, will hold a hearing before an administrative law judge. We will issue a proposed order. Let me just say that the number of proposed orders we issue is very, very, very small. Maybe 1 or 2% out of all of the orders we issue. The other 98% are final orders. But that 1 or 2% tends to be the most political of all of our agencies. These are the Department of Forestry, Division of State Lands, Board of Medical Examiners, these regulatory, occupational, and licensing agencies where typically attorneys are present that do attract most of the heat, not necessarily all the light, but certainly most of the heat from the public and from attorneys. We issue a proposed order. It goes back to the agency. The agency can either accept that proposed order or it can change it. If it doesn't agree with the law, it simply produces a different legal answer. Won't change the facts necessarily. If it, however, wants to change the facts, the agency is required to go into the record and to identify 51% of the evidence that supports the agency's view of the facts. It will then rewrite the order accordingly. That order then becomes a final order of the agency. It then is appealed, if it's going to be appealed at all, to the Court of Appeals. Let me tell you how other states do this. This issue of final order authority is a long, long-standing one in United States administrative law going back decades and decades. I won't test you with the history of it, but it is a fascinating history. Here's what other states do. Of the central panels, of which there are about 22, the majority of them, their Administrative Procedures Act, are silent on this issue. They don't talk about the ability of an agency to address findings or legal conclusions. What that means is the agency can do whatever it wants to do. I'm not judging that. That's just the way it is. A minority of states have done what Oregon has done to put a limit on findings of fact, the ability of an agency to change findings of fact, not conclusions of law. That's a different policy issue. But on findings of fact for Oregon, the agency has defined in the record preponderance, 51%. Other states, for example, North Carolina, South Carolina, said no, that's not enough. We really want the findings of fact of an administrative law judge who, after all, was present at the hearing, saw the witnesses, made the findings. We want those to remain intact. So the standards are different, clear and convincing, or I can't remember right now what those standards are. But they are very, very high standards, which, as a practical matter, make the findings of fact inviolate, not the conclusions of law. There are a couple of states. One of them is Louisiana, whose legislature has gone even further and said to its Office of Administrative Hearings, agencies, you cannot change those findings of fact or conclusions of law at all. Indeed, you can't even appeal from the final order of an administrative law judge. Whether that's the right policy decision or not is another question, but that was their policy decision. So we go from one extreme, the majority rule, if you will, agencies can do whatever they want to findings and conclusions of law, to something in the middle, really holding those findings of fact intact from the ALJ, to Louisiana and one other state, I can't recall at the moment, that you can't, the agency can't touch it at all.
I want to follow up on this, gentlemen. I know a number of members here have had constituents that have contacted them regarding maybe some of their personal experiences they've had. I'm also one of those individuals. And I can tell you that going to one of those licensing boards where they had their day in court, at least they thought they had their day in court, the administrative law judge came back with the decision that was favorable to the constituent, only to have the board in that particular occupation basically gut and rewrite it. But what I'm hearing you say is that for historical facts, which I'm assuming are finding of facts,
right. That
it takes 51% of overturning what the ALJ has done by 51% of those facts. So a couple questions. Number one would be, how is it determined whether they've hit that threshold of 51% of the facts?
Good question. Co-chairs, Senator Brzezinski, that is why that was one of those elements of that compromise in House Rule 2525 that said if that order goes up on appeal then to the Court of Appeals, we're going to give the Court of Appeals de novo review of the facts so that they have the opportunity to review all the facts without being bound by either the ALJ's determination or the agency's determination, and the Court of Appeals will make its own determination of those historical facts. So that's the answer in terms of how do we know if the agency got it right in terms of recounting, recalibrating those facts. That is determined on appeal, and the protection that was built into House Rule 2525 was to give the Court of Appeals de novo review to review those facts completely from the ground up.
Okay, so just for members, de novo means that they start from ground zero,
yeah,
and they would then be looking at basically, let's say, two competing opinions, one that's the final order and one that was a proposed order, and then they're going to basically control all of that out and come up with whatever they think.
So they will find their own facts based on the record. That's correct.
So let me ask you, is there a reason why you would tell us not to require and set a preponderance of evidence before a board or commission would be able to overrule the historical facts finding of a LOJ to clear and convincing?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question. Is there a reason
why
not
we
to
should
go
not
to
go to a higher threshold from preponderance to clear and convincing? Something that actually is going to cause a little bit more for that board to actually overcome before they override a proposed order from the ALJ.
Senator Prezansky, based on my experience with other central panels, and this is an issue that I've done a lot of discussion with my counterparts as well as research, their experience has been fine with raising the threshold of changing findings. There hasn't been a problem. As with anything, when it deals with a central panel, both our experience in Oregon and experience of every 22 states, is there is many times very suspicious, sometimes hostile reaction from agencies. I understand that. I respect it. But once people get used to the new system. One example I can give you to answer your question about how does one determine 51%, it's the agency. The problem with and Lane is correct, that a court of appeals can change that, can review it. The difficulty is this, and I'm not trying to advocate for the position either way, just to give you the information that you need so the right choices can be made. The truth of the matter is this, that in the Office of Administrative Hearings, last year we had 32,400 cases that come before us. Overwhelmingly, these people are people without a lot of means. They come to us unrepresented, overwhelmingly, because they don't have the resources to hire attorneys. But they can do so in our system because our system is geared for the unrepresented. It is geared for them. Court of Appeals is not. I've been an appellate lawyer. It's a much more sophisticated system. So it is rare that any of the final orders from agencies that find against a citizen is appealed simply for that basis. Final little story. I still recall vividly in one of our decisions we found against the agency based upon the findings of fact. The board's own member, one of the board members, had been a witness at that hearing. And the board on final order review decided that its witnesses were more trustworthy than the citizens' witnesses. The ALJ found differently. And so reversed it on that. So they found immediately 51%.
One follow-up on this. So on the de novo, it's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, that when it goes back to the Court of Appeals, they're not taking evidence at that level. They're looking at what the record is has been perfected, both at the administrative law level as well as to whatever changes or modifications that were made at the agency level.
That's correct. Although, if I may, I think it's important. The record really is particularly the factual record, is at the hearing level.
That's correct. Right.
The agency, when it reviews, doesn't take any new evidence. They're looking just at the record, too, that was developed in front of the hearing officer.
That's correct. Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. Gentlemen, could we discuss the policy aspect of ALJ decisions? I mean, I naively believe that legislatures make policy and agencies carry out policies. So in this policy interpretation, is the agency interpretation of the legislative intent? Is this a policy, you know, is this an agency interpretation of the legislative intent? And if in fact that's what it is, isn't that a judicial function rather than an agency function?
Co-chairs, Senator Whitsitt, I think this debate has been going on since the 40s probably, when the federal government first moved into administrative law. I can tell you, at least in terms of, I think, the Oregon system as it's understood today, which is the the assumption on which the Office of Administrative Hearings was based, is that there is a role for agencies in interpreting, and often the legislature delegates that function to agencies. So agencies do interpret not only statutes that they're charged with implementing or regulating, but they also enact their own administrative rules and then interpret those administrative rules. And House Bill 2525 and 2526 didn't make any changes in that assumption that is the way agencies operate. It simply builds on that and recognizes that the hearings process is one of the ways that agencies interpret statutes and administrative rules. A contested case almost always is going to involve an interpretation of a law, and that is within the system that we have in Oregon an accepted function of the agency.
Follow up, Mr. Ewing.
Subject to judicial review.
If I got the numbers correct, at this time, about 98% of all contested cases are decided by LOJs who have final order authority.
Yes, Senator, that's correct.
Okay. Can you tell us in raw numbers approximately how many are not out of that 2%? What does that represent? Is that the 32,000 number that you're giving us?
Senator Prezanski, I'd say roughly of final order or proposed orders we issue 400, 500. Something like that.
Okay.
It's a very small number.
Thank you. What percentage of all of your cases, administrative law cases, are actually agency, board, and commission cases? Aren't the preponderance of yours really implied consent and insurance cases and so forth? So, I mean, when we get down to the 500 where you write a final order, those are primarily for, or when you write a proposed order, those are primarily for those agencies. And what percentage of those are overturned of those 500 as opposed to the 2% of the entire group?
A very good question, Senator Whitsitt. Of the 500, and don't hold me to that exact number, I'm giving you rough dimensions, but it's not too inaccurate. The great majority are from the licensing board and commissions. The others are from construction contractor board, kind of a different area, Department of Human Services, some of them. But the great majority are the Board of Medical Examiners, all the licensing occupational agencies. On the whole, affirm the agency in roughly 80-85% of the time. Most of the time, agencies affirm us. I've been surprised that maybe even 51% or so, something like that, more than half of agencies that have, when we have found against the agency, they've actually agreed with us. So the number of cases in which the agencies have found and which we have found against the agency and the agency then has flipped us is very small. But that's not the end of the problem. And again, I don't want to be seen to be an advocate, but let me tell you what is the other half of this, and that's the front end. An attorney I know who practices in this area says, Ewing, that's not the full answer. The other half of the answer is I have a client, comes into my office, his professional license, his livelihood is being threatened. I want to fight this, the licensee. And he says, the lawyer to his client, understand, please, that we can go in and we can win, but the agency can flip us. And that's the problem. So, and I'm just not trying to make the argument, but trying to give the argument that would have been made were this attorney and other attorneys not here. And we do have a practitioner, Janice Krem, in administrative law. But from their point of view, it's both the front end and that initial consultation with the attorney, as well as what happens at the back end to, in the minds of some, kind of cloud the fairness of the system.
I'd like to ask, Tom, if you could be so kind to prepare for us, if you don't have it already, of those 400 or 500 cases that are proposed orders, give us a breakdown as to how many are from which of the agencies, and then also how many of them, quote unquote, are flipped, so we can kind of see if there's any practice or patterns here.
I'd be happy to do that, Senator.
What I'm trying to say is that if they are agreeing about 50%, that tells me somewhere in the range of a half of these cases
are being flipped, or am I misunderstanding?
Well, I hate to even, it's been a while since I've looked at those numbers, Senator, and I came here only to talk about the history. I wasn't prepared to talk about these other things. But I would say that my recollection when I did look at it, I looked at 4 years of data personally, and I was surprised, pleasantly, that in a majority, not a heavy majority, but a majority of cases, that the agencies did agree with us in the conclusion. Indeed, I've done a couple of occupational cases found against the agency, and the agency has agreed with me.
Thank you.
Other two people? Okay. Any other questions then? If not, then let's excuse Mr. Shetterly and Mr. Ewing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'd like Janice Cram to come forward. No problem at all. Take your time.
Good morning, Chair Profansky and McPherson, members of the Senate and House Judiciary Committees. My name is Janice Krem. I'm an attorney. I practice exclusively in administrative law. Was admitted to practice in 1977. I'm going to tell you just quickly about my background, because I think that my background probably plays into the issues that I'll bring and the recommendations that I make. I was the chief administrative law judge for an agency, which meant I was in charge. I was the executive state employee who was responsible for delivering administrative hearings to the public. So I come from a state background. I've also worked for several state agencies. And as an administrative law judge, I know what it takes to ensure that there is an objective review of an evidence of a record that I've had to develop, and the kind of pressure that would be applied to an administrative law judge when they're housed within an agency and are susceptible to off-the-record communications from agencies. And I'm currently in private practice, and I represent people who come to the administrative law process expecting an objective and fair hearing, which is what we call them, fair hearings. And so my comments today will reflect, I think, all of those experiences and backgrounds, and I think you will find that I come from a sort of a centralist approach to some of the problems that you've heard about today and some of the issues that are percolate continuously through this area of the law. I'm currently the chair of the administrative law section of the Oregon State Bar, but I'm not here on their behalf. I'm here on my own behalf today so that I can bring to bear the differing perspectives that I have as an individual. First, I should say that I am an enthusiastic supporter of the Office of Administrative Hearing. It is a significant improvement in Oregon's administrative law. But as you've heard, there were compromises. And over time, over the last 7 and 8 years, there are issues that have come to rise that I think could be addressed, and that there are some proposals that would make the process work better in terms of the goals that the OAH are supposed to achieve and also the public's confidence in the administrative law system. I think I'll jump right into the first question that seems to be on everybody's mind this morning, and that is what to do about final order authority. This is a hot-ish topic. It's always been. And I think from the introduction that Chief Administrative Law Judge Ewing gave you, I think it's pretty clear that the centrist view is to protect findings of fact that an objective administrative law judge makes from tinkering by the agency, and at the same time to give some authority to the agency to really make final decisions where it's a question of the policy that they've been entrusted to bring forward by the legislature and the governor's office. Why do I say that that's a good solution? Because it sort of balances a lot of the issues that private practitioners have, that the agencies have, and that I presume people who are involved in fair hearings want to do. So I'm not suggesting that you turn the current system on its head. I guess I'm saying that the centrist view would tweak the system so that people have higher confidence in it, and at the same time not run afoul of extremely high feelings that I have found agencies have when anybody threatens their ability to make a final order decision. So I would recommend that, because there are so few orders that are issued that are not final orders, that you give administrative law judges, I'm going to call them ALJs, final order authority, and only when there's a reason for the agency to get involved should those orders be called back for any kind of review by the agency. So if you want to save money and you want to speed up the system, just let the ALJs issue the final orders. And then curtail exactly what it is an agency can do. Agencies who change findings of fact don't hear the evidence. They don't see the witnesses. They are not trained adjudicators. They don't understand how to create a record. They haven't been trained as lawyers or as administrative law judges to how to weigh evidence. What evidence is persuasive? How do you weigh it? How do you look at two experts' opinions, and how do you draw conclusions from it that are the kind of heightened technical skills that an administrative law judge should have? So rather than having them rethink the facts and the evidence on a cold record, we call it a cold record, which means they never see anybody. They don't hear anybody. They just have some paper in front of them, and they're supposed to reweigh evidence from testimony they've never heard. In my opinion, my humble opinion in this count, that's probably not the best use of administrative law judge services or the system. What you might want to do, though, is make sure that when the agency has a beef with how an administrative law judge is actually interpreting agency policy, that the agency has a right to pull the order back and to file an amended final order. And it would be about agency policy. Now, there's two things that will make this work well. You have to have agencies, and you'll find it later in some of my materials, you've got to have agencies who actually can articulate their policy and that people can actually find. So one of the things that would improve the system would be to have agencies required to publish their final orders and precedent in an accessible database. Technology is here that would make agency decisions that they've made and policy that they've created readily accessible. It would be accessible to the Attorney General's office, to people like me who are trying to understand my client's position in terms of how the agency has previously interpreted itself. It would help the ALJ, who's got to apply the agency policy. So I would say that when you improve the system by making ALJs interpret findings of fact and making agencies on the hook ultimately for policy decisions, that you better upgrade the quality of both of their activities. The way you improve an ALJ's ability to make good findings of fact, create a good record, is to make sure that they're attorneys. Not only are they attorneys, attorneys spend thousands and thousands of dollars learning this. It is a bargain for the state of Oregon to hire an ALJ who's already put in bucks to become brilliant technicians in this area, and we ought to cull that kind of training and pull it into the ALJs. ALJs, who are attorneys also, should be members of a bar somewhere, if not the Oregon State Bar, some bar, because that means that they are held to an ethical standard that currently ALJs are not particularly held to. ALJs are not subject to the Code of Judicial Conduct, which applies to judges, because they're not elected officials. However, they would be subject to ethical standards that would keep them true and on target if there's members of some state bar. And that would ensure that as attorneys admitted to practice and before some state bar, that they're going to perform. We have a really sound way of making sure they're going to do a good job finding facts and compiling a record and analyzing legal issues. On the other hand, for agencies, as I said before, you want to up their responsibilities by making sure that they can articulate and they can make available in an accessible form their policy decisions, their final orders. Many agencies simply do not publish their final orders. If you make a request, they will very kindly tell you that you are welcome to look over the last 10 or 20 years of final orders, and if you can find the pertinent precedent, good luck, because I'll lead into another issue that I think is important for us to review, which is discovery. The concept of discovery is that you can go to an agency and say, what final order or precedent are you applying in this case? I'd like to know. I'd also like to know what you have acquired in your file that you're using against my client, or that you may have that supports my client's position. This is generally a topic that comes up in traditional civil and criminal proceedings, but doesn't happen in administrative law. There is no right to discovery in administrative practice under the Administrative Procedures Act. So if an agency chooses to let you have it, then you get it. If agencies choose not to let you have it, you don't get it, which means that you cannot, for instance, talk to a witness who has information that would help your client because you have no way of preparing for that hearing by requiring them to talk to you. So one of the things that would improve the quality of the record and the quality of the system would be for attorneys to have, for parties who are preparing for hearings and determining whether they want to settle the case, would be their ability to have limited discovery. And I use the term limited because I really mean it. I know the administrative law section of the Oregon State Bar has come up in previous sessions with some ways to deal with this, which gives a hierarchy, which says we don't want to have, we've heard what agencies have to say, we do not want to have discovery that's so onerous and so difficult that agencies are struggling to respond to the kinds of requests you make. But we would say that if you have a hierarchy where you can get discovery of the file, you can have access to witnesses, and if you ask the agency to tell you what their precedent is, their policy is, their previous decisions are, that they will actually tell you. And that things like depositions, which can be expensive and can be onerous, that those are not readily available, and that they're only available under certain limited circumstances where there's not other ways to get information. And ultimately, once you give the right to limited discovery, then you need to have a process where if the agency doesn't feel that it's a proper request and the party thinks it is, then it would go to an objective person who understands evidence, who understands discovery, who understands what it takes to create a good record, and that is the administrative law judge. And the administrative law judge would then be able to determine whether a request for discovery is onerous, inefficient, ineffectual, or appropriate and proper way for a person to prepare for their hearing when their license is on the line or their livelihood. So I think I've talked about final orders, discovery. Let me talk a little bit about ex parte communications. Basically, this is just off-the-record comments. The reason that this is always an issue that keeps coming up is because the OAH addressed it. And it's the legislation that created it. So for those agencies that are actually within the Office of Administrative Hearings, there is some minimal standards about how agencies can influence agency administrative law judges. But the information, the standards that apply to the OAH only apply to administrative law judges who work for the OAH. There's no universal standard for how agencies outside of the OAH deal with ex parte communications, off the record communications that could influence the result. I call them secret communications. And there's no standard for how secret communications to the actual decision maker, the actual agency heads, are handled. So what you have is that people have an impression that they create this record where it's very careful, it's very considered, it's supposed to be the only thing that the decision is made on, but nothing prevents the agency decision makers who are going to issue in under the current system the final order, the final decision, from having a backroom conversation with anybody on their staff about anything. And unless that agency appreciates the fact that this is off the record and should be disclosed, then this information never comes to light. The party believes that the decision is being made on a particular record, but in fact the agencies are very insistent that they have the ability for their staff to communicate with the agency decision makers and the administrative law judges. Now, there are reasons why an agency wants to have those communications, and as an agency person, I understand what they are. One of the reasons is that they want to hear from their attorney. They're represented by an attorney. They have some difficult policy questions to make. They have some findings of fact under the current system that they need to consider. So when you put together some ex parte communication provisions that are going to protect the record and make sure that the decision is actually made on it, you want to make sure that there are some allowances for certain kinds of communications coming from the agency's own attorney to the agency to make sure that their decisions are based on the law. if you look at the Office of Administrative Hearings standards, they're minimal standards. I think agencies should have the right and the ability to have higher standards about off-the-record communications, and my suggestion wouldn't be to curtail that, but I certainly think that it would be helpful for people's confidence in the system to know that before agencies are being persuaded by agency staff, that those that persuasive information be shared with the party who might have an equally persuasive argument that they would like to feel that they get to bring to bear on the ultimate decision-making in the case. Let's see. I gave you, I think, a six-page document. I will spare you six pages of
we do appreciate that, and we'll probably go a bit past noon in order to hear from Mr. Schrable, but if you could kind of hit the high points here at this point so we could...
I won't go through all of my points. The last issue I would want to make that I think would ultimately put a lot more confidence in the system is how the procedural rules for hearings are created. The procedural rules for hearings are much like the rules of civil procedure for civil cases or the rules for criminal procedure. And in administrative law, those rules about how evidence is created, who gets to present it, when documents are due, all the rules that apply to how these things proceed, they're not written by a consortium of users or stakeholders or an independent body. Those rules of procedure are actually created and written by and are uniformly applied by the attorney who represents the agency who's prosecuting the case. That has a tendency to make people believe, if not it actually being true, that they could be more even-handed than they currently are. And if you look through some of the administrative procedural rules, you will see that they have a tendency to ensure that the agency's case is presented and that there are a certain amount of procedural hurdles that apply to the party who's trying to bring their case that wouldn't apply to the agency. I think that can be fixed. I think what the easy fix would be is to have those procedural rules created and proposed through rulemaking through a consortium of stakeholders that would reflect not only the agency's position and the attorney's position, but frankly, a real respect for the fact that most people are unrepresented and they're not going to understand how to jump through the hurdles of a complicated administrative procedure, rules of procedure. I'm going to go two other issues that I think are very important to my heart and spare you the information, but I did present it in written materials, and I would love to talk to anybody who's interested at any time. Thank you for your time and your patience.
Thank you, Ms. Graham. Are there any questions? Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Graham, that's some of the most cogent testimony I've ever heard. I have to tell you,
thank you very much.
I've been here a long time, and you've laid out the problems that we have with Office of Administrative Hearings. You've laid out the ways that we can improve it, and quite frankly, I'm appalled at the behavior that we have in the system because, first of all, not publishing final orders is ridiculous. There's no establishment of case law, so how's anyone ever going to know what an agency has done in the past and how you can prepare your case in the future? The fact that you can't have discovery. I mean, I frankly don't know how a citizen can ever win against an agency under these kinds of onerous circumstances. So I really appreciate the homework that you've done. I'm going to review your six pages in more detail. But you've done a very good job of laying it out, and I just want to thank you for that.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Anything else? Ms. Krim, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Schradl. Takes me a minute. Never hurt your knee. It totally disrupts your life. Chair McPherson, Chair Bozanski, members of the committees, Philip Schradl with the Department of Justice. I'm actually here potentially wearing two hats, so let me dispense with one of them early on. I am the chair of the Office of Administrative Hearings Oversight Committee, and that's a committee that has four members of the legislature who are on that, and two of them are here, Senator Bonamici and Senator Whitsitt, Representative Berger and Representative Hovey are also legislative participants in that. I'm one of the appointees from the Attorney General's office, as well as Christine Shute. And then there are two gubernatorial appointees, David Reese, who's going to be superseded, I believe, by Kelly Skye in the near future, and Kevin Schubert, who's a private practitioner. We're working our way through hearing from a number of interested constituents, interested participants in the process, developing a report that we'll be providing to the Legislative Assembly at the beginning of the legislative session. We've not yet reached determination about a number of issues that are pending before the Office of Administrative Hearings Oversight Committee. So I'm not here today to report kind of results or progress from the Oversight Committee. What I'd rather like to do is testify from a position of being a Department of Justice representative. And obviously, the administrative agencies that are part of the administrative process are a substantial, a primary player in the administrative process. I want to take a step back for just a moment about administrative law. Administrative law, when it was created, was designed to be an opportunity for an agency to get through a somewhat formalized, but very much less formalized process than court litigation, information that led to its final decision when it rendered its order. I think an awful lot of the discussion that's before you today has shown that there's been kind of a paradigm shift and a view shift, that the agency acts when it issues its notice of intent, and the whole thing after that is an adjudicatory process. And I submit to you that that's not an accurate portrayal, that is at the very beginning of the outset of this, and the hearing process is an opportunity for everybody that's going to be affected by that to have an opportunity to get the information relevant to the matter to the agency, with the agency then making its decision at the end of that process. And the reason I say that is an awful lot of what has happened in the intervening 20 years or so has been a formalization and a creation of a much more highly litigious adjudicatory process. One other high-level point that I want to make for you is that one of the things that I want you to keep in mind as you think your way through issues is that agencies aren't there for their own purpose. Agencies are there because of the statutory purposes that you folks have put in place to implement their statutory programs that you've charged them with, and in many opportunities, in many circumstances, to defend the public interest and to protect public safety. As you've heard testimony today, in the vast majority of cases that go before the Office of Administrative Hearings, final order authority has been delegated to the administrative law judges in the process. Those cases are a substantial portion, are high-volume cases in which there aren't policy matters or big legal issues involved. That's not that they aren't important cases, but the high volume level of those, like implied consent cases, unemployment insurance cases, DHS benefit claim cases, those are typically single issue cases that don't have tremendous factual records. Where the issue, the crux of the matter, really boils down to is in more the licensing and regulatory area. That is where you statutorily have, in fact, charged the agencies with developing the appropriate standards of care, the appropriate standards against which to apply the facts that are involved in the matter to find out if somebody has been dealing unprofessionally, impermissibly, in violation of an agent or a profession standard. I know I don't have an awful lot of time, but I want to highlight two things for you. Back in 1980, Governor Attia issued an executive order. And in that executive order, he exempted many, many state agencies from the then existing statutory provision that would make proposed orders become final after 30 days unless the agency did something about them. And the idea behind that was if an agency didn't take any action at all, the proposed order became final. In issuing his executive order, he had the following thing to say. My reason for granting this exemption is that the ultimate decision-making responsibility for adjudicating contested cases should be with the department heads or governing boards as prescribed by statute. The hearings officer's role should be limited to conducting the hearing and making recommendations to the agency head. Hearings officers should not, as a general rule, be given any final decision-making authority. The citizens of Oregon expect department heads and agency governing boards to accept the responsibility for decisions with which they've been charged. You, the Legislative Assembly, in ORS 670-275, kind of echoed that kind of a statement. Now, I'm dealing here primarily with licensing and regulatory boards, but in ORS 670-275, that statute states, it is the intention of the Legislative Assembly to retain responsibility for decisions on qualifications, standards of practice, licensing, discipline, and other discretionary functions relating to professional activities and the professional licensing boards, members of which are qualified by education, training, and experience to make the necessary judgments. The reason I read those two statements to you is an awful lot of the turmoil and concerns that you hear expressed have to do with matters in the licensing and regulatory context. The boards and commissions that exist in the licensing and regulatory context are chosen and appointed because of the experience, the expertise, the knowledge that they can bring to bear. Now, you heard some questions made about findings of fact. Findings of fact aren't all of the same ilk. They aren't whether the light was green or the light was red. There are some of those findings of fact are, did this doctor in fact use an appropriate method in treating this patient? Some of these are incredibly complex matters that I think are most appropriately for resolution by the people that you have charged with implementing that statutory program, the licensing and regulatory boards that can bring their history, their experience, their understanding of the profession to bear on those kinds of determinations. I want to particularly address the exchange, Senator Przanski, Chair Przanski, that you've had about a standard. Right now, In the standard that applies as to whether you can change a finding of fact, there is a considered determination made that it should be preponderance of the evidence and that then it would be reviewed de novo. And I'd submit to you that if you move that standard to something like a clear and convincing standard or any other standard that's higher than a preponderance, what you're actually doing is forcing the agency decision maker to sign, issue, publish an order with which they disagree. And that means that it really no longer is the agency's order. You are asking an agency to issue and publish an order with which they disagree. Significantly, in the legislative concept that's been circulated, I understand, to all the members of the committees, in the cover letter from David Hendricks with Legislative Council, he has a couple of questions in that cover letter, which I think are very significant questions. And that is, if you move to final order authority residing in the administrative law judge, it is no longer, I think the answer to that is self-evident, is no longer the agency's order. That means that what you have really done is taken the locus of responsibility from those who are charged statutorily with implementing and instituting that program to a cadre of administrative law judges. And if you do that, what you've really done is you have taken responsibility for the statutory programs out of the agency decision makers, the final agency decision makers, and put that responsibility with the administrative law judges. That has a number of disconnects associated with it. Part of the reason of having a final decision maker is to have consistency in application. If you have that residing within a cadre of administrative law judges, inconsistency can creep into that process very easily because you have a number of different administrative law judges rendering decisions. You don't have the accountability, and you've lost the expertise, the substantive expertise, in the area of the profession, the practice. And so that's why we have been opposed to any kind of a move towards final order authority because in administrative law judges, because we believe that the locus of responsibility, the people charged with that responsibility, should be the ones who issue the final orders. And like I say, there are adequate and significant safeguards that exist in the current system on final order authority because of the de novo review by the court. They are not going to be, deferring to anybody when they review that order. If you change that system, then it's going to have ramifications clear across. The last piece of general large picture issues that I want to leave with you for your consideration are the Administrative Procedures Act applies to every administrative agency in the state of Oregon. It has broad impact along a large set of decisions that get made in a whole variety of contexts. Changes to the Administrative Procedures Act need to be very, very, very carefully thought out because the ramifications of that are significant. The compromise that exists in ORS, well, it's 183650 and on now, was very carefully wrought. And if we're going to upset that at this point in time, I think, and I suggest to you that you need to give that very, very, very careful consideration because the matters, while administrative law doesn't really rise to the radar screen of many, many people, it has significant impacts on people's lives, not just the people involved in the process, but the patients, the people who are going to get treatment, the future clients of people who are being subjected to potential license or regulatory action. It's easy to have kind of a parade of people come here who are individual people who have had an agency proceeding. But remember that the other side of that equation is the public who need the protection from people who are incapable of performing professionally or, you know, ill-willed people or for whatever reason are unable to meet the professional standard that the licensing board and commissions are there to enforce. So remember, it's not the agency who's enforcing it for their own benefit. It's the agencies who are enforcing matters because they have a public service, a public protection aspect to their reason for being, really. I mean, you've charged them with that. I'm happy to, you know, talk about any issues. I have a lot of passion myself about all of these issues. I would engage you in conversations till the cows come home. So,
well, before we go there,
yes,
you two may be going till the cows come home, but we'll go for some. But we do have another meeting. The one thing I do want to just make sure we're going to be for those who are part of the Tort Claim Act. We're scheduled to start at 1:30. We have Senate. A confirmation hearing starting at 3, so we're going to try to start right at 1:30. We're trying to give members time to eat and all that have to return.
Understood.
But fire away.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not surprisingly, I disagree with some of the things you said. But, you know, basically, if I understand it, you're saying the license and regulatory boards who have already made a decision to bring charges prior to a hearing that the ALJ will hear, that they should also have the ability to adjudicate those charges. And I think that's following that, I mean, that once the agency then, in your view, has adjudicated those charges and has decided one way or another, then the citizen can go on to the Court of Appeals, and that's his only resolution of the issue.
Co-chairs and Senator Whitsitt, I think maybe we have a fundamental disagreement about what the notice of intent to do something by an agency is. I think sometimes people take with that the agency has made up its mind. At that point in time, they have issued a notice of intent to do something. And there are circumstances. I mean, I don't have, you know, anecdotal information in front of me, but there are circumstances I can guarantee you that when the notice went out, the ultimate decision is not to bring any, you know, to find any charges well-founded. They are taking what the information that they have, and this process is designed to develop the record for them to make the final decision about whether to actually impose any sanction at all or not. So it's not the functional equivalent of, you know, the investigatory matters that a district attorney's office will undertake before they bring criminal charges. It's not that function. It's not the same thing. This administrative process is designed to get the information for the agency to make its decision. And the notice of intent is that to trigger that process.
Yeah. One short follow-up, and I'll leave it alone. Okay.
Sure.
But then you mentioned the agency wanted to develop the record, but we have very restricted discovery, so the citizen really doesn't have much of an opportunity to develop the record.
Co-chairs and Senator Whitsitt, remember that in the background there's a public records law that says that any record that an agency has is available to anybody who asks for it. It's also incumbent upon an agency to fully and fairly develop the record. And in any information that the agency is going to rely upon for its decision at all needs to be placed on the record. And so, and typically, agencies will respond by providing anything that they have in their files when people make requests. If you head down the path of formal discovery along the lines of civil litigation, know that there will be costs, fiscal costs associated with that, that will make, again, one of the reasons for creating the administrative process in the very beginning was to have a cost-effective, quick, less formal proceeding available so that you didn't have everything going into court litigation. If you head into formal discovery, then I think you also need to be very cognizant that there will be opportunities sought for depositions of agency decision makers for, as any civil litigant knows, I mean, how civil litigation plays out now is it's through discovery, onerous discovery, and motions practice. And I worry that what is really happening is that we are headed there in the administrative process, and what we are going to make this happen is that everybody's going to need to have counsel. It's going to be extremely time-consuming, costly, and with no net result that is to the benefit of anyone.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you, Mr. Tradel. I'm not sure I can make this into a question, so maybe just a comment to reiterate what Mr. Tradel said about the complexity of the issue. And I think that really focusing on what is the role of an administrative hearing and the whole purpose of an administrative hearing, it is to be different from a judicial proceeding. And when I was asking the question about the change in the name from the hearings officer to the administrative law judge, I think that among the people who go in, the citizens who go in for an administrative hearing, when they hear that this is a judge, they think that the judge is making a decision. So I wasn't in this business at the time, but I think I would have had a problem with that change just because of the perception that it creates among the people going in for the hearing. And I also wanted to kind of follow up on a comment that Mr. Ewing had made about the attorney who said the problem is at the front end because, according to this attorney, they said to the client that, you know, you can win, but then it can be flipped. And my sense is that any attorney who's saying you can win in front of an administrative hearing isn't explaining what the actual process is, because it isn't really winning. And that's a way of sort of looking at the picture. You explained to you don't say you're going to win from the administrative law judge if in fact it's a recommendation to the administrative agency. So it is a complex issue. I think we need to take our time looking at these proposals. Okay.
Representative Porras.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schrael, just for clarification, in the earlier portion of your comments to us, you indicated that in the administrative law process, it's the adjudication proceedings and people are trying to get information in order to develop the record. And that would give me the sense that if you get as much information as you can or that is feasible for either the agency or the civil person litigant, used in quotes. But I thought that I recall hearing Mr. Ewing say that sometimes we don't have 100% of the information that develops the record. And that's unfortunate, but it's the way it is. So can you give me some clarification there?
Co-Chair, as Representative Flores, if I understood Mr. Ewing's comment, I think it was that in the exigencies of time, sometimes the record doesn't get as fully developed as you might like to have it by the parties before the administrative law judge. Within the, by way of background, though, in the administrative process, the normal rules of evidence aren't strictly applied at all. And in fact, administrative law judges are charged with letting in all relevant information that is reasonably relied upon people in their the conduct of their serious affairs. That's a much lower threshold than in the evidentiary standard that you need to meet in civil litigation or in criminal litigation. So the idea behind the administrative process is not to keep information out, but to have an informal standard that lets as much information in as possible. I think his, Mr. Ewing's response was more a practical response, that sometimes because of, you know, everybody's harried schedules, that maybe something that could be developed 2 months out might not be able to be presented at the hearing because they need to meet strict timelines to make the process work. It's not that people are not allowed to provide information. It's just that maybe the information isn't available. I hope that's helpful.
It's helpful for the clarification. I appreciate that. I think it opens up a whole series of concerns. But thank you.
Any other questions? Then thank you very much, Mr. Schradl. Thank you.
Mr. Schradl, before you leave, we have two members here that are on the Oversight Committee. I know that you are, too. I am going to ask the Oversight Committee if you'll take Ms. Krim's suggestions, review them, and see what type of response you would have when you're going to be reporting back to us so we can see what she's presented as to what the Oversight Committee thinks of it.
Chair Pozanski will do so. Thank you.
Very good. Well, thank you, members, for staying beyond what was our targeted noon break time. Some of you will be back here in this room at 1:30 sharp to start out our Tort Claims Task Force meeting.
Chair, could you confirm when our next meetings are? I got an email from Patsy. So I think she talked to her.
So,
our next meeting is going for Judiciary will be October 30th. The October 16th meeting that was scheduled has now been moved to November 17th, based on what I have. We went over this morning. So we were scheduled to meet twice in October, the 16th, and we're scheduled to meet on the 16th and the 30th of October. What we have done, and as of this morning, the preliminary stuff I saw was that we were meeting Judiciary schedule will be the 30th of October, November the 17th, and we still have our December 11th meeting. So we still have three meetings left. We're just not doing two in October. We're breaking out because of other commitments.
Okay, very good. That concluding the business of the Interim House Judiciary Committee, that committee meeting is adjourned.
And the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary also is concluded for today.